what you made me do. Look what you just made me do. Look what you just made me do. Look what you made me do.
Hello and welcome to The Download. Look what they're making us do, Chris Jones. We're filling in for Justin Kaufman on The Download. It is 7:14 on WGN Chicago. We are happy to be here. I am Mark Caro. That's Chris Jones.
How you doing, everybody? Thank you for joining us on The Download. Fantastic to be here once again.
We are happy to be here. We're going to be talking about Houston, of course. We're going to be talking about the floods. And we have a writer down at the Houston Chronicle who writes about theater. He's going to tell us what's happening in the theater art scene. We also have an actor who is stranded in the Four Seasons Hotel. We also have Taylor Swift to talk about. So it's like you got the weighty stuff, and then you got Taylor Swift, who's setting all sorts of records with her new song that you just heard a little bit about, a bit of. So, Chris Jones, it's sort of an interesting time to be commenting on cultural affairs, huh?
It's kind of a crazy time, isn't it? It's like we've got the Houston thing, as you say, all kinds of stuff going on down there. A little soggy down there, to say the least. I'm just excited to be here talking on The Download. We've got a packed show.
We do. We have Jeff Wells of Hollywood Elsewhere. This is a blog that I read compulsively, and he's going to be on in the 8 o'clock hour.
What is that blog, Mark Carroll? The
Hollywood Elsewhere. He's been doing blogs. I've been reading him for years and years and years. You might even say decades. I don't know. It's like he's been blogging since they were blogging. He was on Movie Poop Shoop for a while. He was on Real.com. He was in all sorts. And he's... he's one of these guys who he posts like four things a day, and some of it will be kind of nuts, and he'll tell you some of his own sort of personal psychodramas and his problems with, you know, actors who he thinks have gotten too fat or something. But he'll also just obsessively get into what movies are coming to Telluride and what he thinks is going to be really good, and we're going to be the Oscar movies this year, and what are the best films so far this year. And it's this very kind of exhaustive, and some might say exhausting, but I get a kick out of it, just kind of handicap of just the year in film as it's going on, looking back, looking forward, and he's going to share some of that with us.
And we're also going to talk about the name change of the Hard Rock Hotel to the St. Jane, no less.
Yeah, that sounds like fun, going to St. Jane. Let's go to St. What happens at St. Jane stays at St. Jane.
They're going to throw away their guitars, presumably, and they're going to bring named in Jane Addams.
Named after Jane Addams, so not the actress.
So we're going to talk with a knowledgeable dude on that, a Tribune Business columnist, going to come in and talk about that. We're going to sort of talk about a little bit about what's going on Wabash Avenue, where they are installing fabulous new lights. Yeah, do you know about that? That's exciting.
New lights on Wabash.
New lights on Wabash.
How about
that's going to be cool. And we're also going to talk a little bit about, you know, I think just these issues, Mark Caro, of the, you know, what do we now name things after, which, of course, has been a huge debate.
I think that's a good, you know, like Balbo, for instance.
Balbo,
we could talk about that.
Yeah.
Got some thematic music to hook into Balbo that's going to surprise you. So there are all these things to talk about. And then, you know, also, Chris, I'm always asking you to come join me on the last Tuesday of the month, because my writer's group meets on the last Tuesday of the month, and we hang out in a Northside bar. I'm not going to tell you, all of you people, I might later, but you'll all just, you know, be crowding around us because it's such an exciting place to be. But a bunch of my writer friends, we sort of sit there every the last Tuesday of every month, and this is the last Tuesday of the month, and
I can't
be there.
So the writer's group is going
to
be,
and you
right
never
here.
Show up, so you know what? We're bringing the writer's group to the studio
all right.
10 o'clock. So they're going to, and it's the birthday of one of them.
It's kind of like therapy, right? Therapy for writers.
It is therapy, right? Because we don't actually write anything or talk about writing, but we talk about how we want to write. And that's
the key.
Well, you'll hear more about
it.
You will be, so this is my way of actually forcing you to come to one of our writers'
all
groups.
Right.
I'm bringing
well, I'm
it into the studio of WGN. But Taylor Swift, let's talk about that briefly. Because you don't want to talk about it too long, but why not? You know, this clip just had the biggest debut of any video in YouTube history, which is one of those, you know, huge records, except you sort of figure someone else is going to. You know what? You know what song it broke the record of?
What's that?
Size Gentleman.
Really?
Yeah. See, you would not have guessed that.
I would never have guessed
that. How many of you? All right. How many of you in Radio Land would have guessed that? Raise your hands right now. Call up 312-981-7200 or text us and you can chime in on this stuff. But yes, it had. It had 31 million views. No, it had 43.2 million views in 24 hours. I looked just before the show. It's up at 64 million now. And what is this song? It's like an I'm Too Sexy rewrite in which she seems like she's complaining about stuff with Kanye. This is one of my problems, aside from just being an older dude trying to, you know, assess pop music, which I realize does not, you know, look very good. it drives me a little crazy that these people take 3 years now between albums, and then, or, you know, and then they come out with something that's so kind of insular, and it's like, oh, okay, this is the latest celebrity war chapter. Katy Perry's song was about Taylor Swift, and now Taylor Swift's song is about Kanye West, I guess. But it's like, who cares? Like, I feel like the whole national government is one big celebrity war. So maybe, you know, writing about something else would be good.
I always feel a bit like, you know, one of Taylor Swift's great assets has been her ability to talk about her own issues, if you like, or her own relationships, but make them fundamentally relatable so that the listener to her music can always go, yeah.
Yeah, she's singing about Jake Gyllenhaal or John Mayer, but I can still relate to that song.
But it doesn't matter because I'm like, yeah, I've got bad blood with this guy.
Right.
And so that people feel that.
And it's catchy.
And I think this newest song takes a leap away from that because, for one thing, she shifts into first person halfway through those lyrics. I was like sitting there this morning, like, okay, I'm going to really read these lyrics, and they do that to a point, but she sort of is shifting away from that, and she's actually taking on a villainous persona. Now, if you want to take a sympathetic view of this, you know, it's almost like David Bowie, like in the creation of a persona.
But he didn't sing about himself being the Thin White Duke. He sang songs in the persona of the Thin White Duke, so it's different. Even Madonna, when she was switching persona, was still singing about things other than being Madonna until later, when she was like, I'm Madonna. But that was sort of when she was quite a bit older than, you know, Taylor Swift is now, when she was singing about being Madonna, or Prince started singing about being Prince. But most of these people reinvent themselves by singing about other things. And I think maybe that's part of it, is that Taylor Swift has been in such an insular world that writing what you know is about being Taylor Swift, being annoyed with Kim Kardashian and Kanye West. And it's sort of too bad. It's like, you know, maybe, you know, take a month in the Himalayas or something.
I don't know. I think she's actually trying to create a persona. I think there's actually the creation of a character here that's a complex, that I think potentially is a, call me crazy, but is a complex sort of multifaceted shift. And in some ways, you could argue that as a mature artist, that's not a bad way to go. By the way, what is a titled stage?
You know, tilted.
Tilted. Oh, is tilted. It tilted?
Tilted. You're getting a tilted stage.
T-I-T-L-E-D?
Tilted, like the tilted kilt.
So like it's like a rake.
Your favorite restaurant.
It's a rake.
It's a tilted stage, which Kanye West was doing some stuff.
Is that a rake? Is that the same thing as a rake?
Well, a rake is like more in the stands, the house, right? The stage.
No, but you can have a rake stage.
You could have a rake stage. Yeah, I think Kanye West was doing some stuff with tilting the stage. So I think it's a reference to Kanye West. Yeah, everyone's decoding the song I just don't care. It's not like, I guess it's, you know, the American Pie of this year or something. Everyone's going to decode it. But it's all about a celebrity feud. And, you know, we don't, you know, I don't know. I don't need the celebrity feud part of it. Yes, it's not a titled stage. It's a tilted stage.
I still say she's making a move towards a more.
But it's like, it's like, oh, Taylor Swift, that Taylor's dead now. Like, okay. It's just so on the nose. I don't know. I realize this is a bad look. I just sound like a crank. It's fine. I support Taylor Swift. And I mean, the cover of her, the cover of her album, Reputation, all this, you know, tabloid stuff about her. I just would love for this culture to like think about what else is going on in the world besides that. I think we have to go to a commercial. So I'm going to send it to us right now. But Chris Jones and Mark Caro on the download for Justin Kaufman. Play ball, celebrate the Cubs with team memorabilia, exclusive books, and so much more. Visit ChicagoTribuneStore.com today.
Everybody's a dreamer, and everybody's a star. Everybody's in movies.
We're all celebrities now. Chris Jones, Mark Caro, filling in for Justin Kaufman on the download. You're just discussing celebrity. Chris watched the Video Music Awards. You watched like the whole thing, right?
Katy Perry, most of it.
Katy Perry, not a career as a stand-up comedian.
Like a basketball thing? Like on a bungee cord above a basketball?
Well, she was an astronaut too, yeah. Her album flopped. I mean, her album, like her single was all about, you know, karma about Taylor Swift. And then Taylor Swift's got in a line of karma about Katy Perry. I don't know. Maybe you just need some new talent to come in. But Chris, you have something more substantial for us to talk about very, very soon.
I think. So we're going to talk about the renaming coming up right after the break. We're going to talk about the renaming of the Hard Rock Hotel for Jane Addams, one of the great icons of Chicago history, who, of course, was the founder of the Hull Houses, was really the instigator of the immigrants' rights movement in Chicago. And I don't anticipate that if you've been Jane Addams doing your thing, that you would have expected in 2017 to all of a sudden.
I was going to say, someone you associate with luxury hotels.
Named after you. Jane Addams. So we're going to talk with one of my fabulous colleagues at the Chicago Tribune. Going to come on and talk to us a little bit about what that means. And, you know, and also I think we can chat a bit about, and if you want to, you know, give us a call, 981-7200 on just this debate going on and what things are named after. I think I get the sense that they thought very carefully about, okay, number one job when renaming a hotel is don't offend anybody these days.
So you put Saint in front of Jane Addams.
Why
name,
would you do that?
And then you
why
go,
would you
and then
do
you go
that?
And then you go high end.
Why would you do that?
Well, we'll discuss this. We'll discuss this segment with Ryan.
It's gonna be a great segment. Stick around, everybody.
Be good, yeah. So we're gonna do that in just a minute and what else we got going on, Chris?
Well, we're gonna sort of take it down to Houston and see what's going on down there as well. And we're gonna sort of find out what it's like on the ground there culturally as well. Like what's going on with all the, you know, with all the cultural institutions who have shows to do, who have an economy to booster. What's that like when your theater is underwater, which really is the case down there? I was just watching, I don't know if you saw this, just watching this whole thing of all these neighborhoods underwater, like stories and stories. Amazing.
Right. So, okay, we got another quick break, and then we will be right back with the download. Thank you very much.
Let's buy a hotel. Let's get a yacht.
Hello, and welcome back to the download with your guest hosts, Mark Caro and Chris Jones. Say hi, Chris.
How you doing, guys? Nice
there
to
you
be
go.
Here on the download.
Yeah, we're filling in for Justin Kaufman, and we're very happy to be here, and we're talking about a bunch of things, and, you know, hotel. So, you know, the Hard Rock Hotel, right? You got the Hard Rock Cafe, and then you have the Hard Rock Hotel sitting right across the river from where we're sitting now on Michigan Avenue. It never felt like it completely took off, and apparently the people who own it agree. Is that what's going on, Chris Jones?
Yeah, so there's a name change at the Hard Rock Hotel in Chicago, and joining us right now on the phone is Tribune business columnist Ryan Ory. How you doing, Ryan? Hello, Ryan. Are you with us on the download?
Yep, I'm here.
Hi, Ryan.
How you doing? You're on with Chris and Mark. So, okay, so our understanding is that they're renaming the Hard Rock Hotel for Jane Addams, who they're not just calling it the Jane Addams Hotel, which would be one choice. They're calling it the St. Jane. So, you know, you're an expert on real estate and hotels and all that. Tell us what exactly is going on. Why are they doing this? The Hard Rock is a huge brand. All of a sudden, it's called the St. Jane for a party hotel. Tell us what's going on.
Yeah, well, I think it's part of kind of a movement where a lot of hotel guests are kind of seeking, rather than chains or kind of brands that they know, a lot of people are looking for something that's kind of unique, and it has maybe a story particular to the city they're in or to the building that the hotel is in. And so I think that's what they're thinking is on the rebranding. What's unusual about this particular rebranding is that the some other hotels on Michigan Avenue, like London House or Chicago Athletic Association, are sort of particular stories to the buildings that they're in.
Right.
Whereas this is honoring a great figure in Chicago history who, you know, did social work before social worker was even a word or even a term.
It's a place where people would stay, the Hull House, right?
Yeah, it was essentially the invention of immigrant settlement houses. It was a notion of creating social programs. I mean, isn't it just a bit weird, don't you think, Ryan, to have a hotel that's like, I don't know.
Are they going to theme it for like immigrants to make it look like, oh, here's your sort of settlement, your five diamond settlement hotel?
Yeah, I don't know that it might be a little out of the price range of the average immigrant, just fresh into the country. That's the kind of unusual twist to this is that, it's going to be at the high end of the price spectrum. They're doing a lot of upgrades to the space that the Hard Rock is going to close late this year. It's going to be the whole space is going to be redone and they're going to unveil some kind of higher end touches and make it a close to the highest end. You can stay in. And here you have the name, as you mentioned,
right?
Synonymous with working with immigrants and poor and, you know, looking out for women's rights in a time when, you know, women couldn't even vote and didn't really have a voice. And so that's the sort of,
I mean, do they risk a backlash when you take a sort of a beloved figure like that and just attack, you know, as you say, it's nothing to do with that building. Do they risk a backlash in terms of like, people are like, look, that's not what she stood for. She was not about partying people from Indianapolis on a Saturday night in the suite at the Hard Rock Hotel. Is it, doesn't it seem to you like I guess I'm asking if it's a mistake in your mind.
Well, it seems like a little bit of a risk, for sure. But you know, I've kind of heard mixed reactions so far since I wrote about this.
Yeah.
Some people are glad, like something is going to be named, something in a prominent location for this person. Then people will maybe, particularly people coming to Chicago and visiting, will educate themselves about who this was and maybe learn some history. And so that's a good thing. But yeah, on the other hand, some people might see it as, you know, gosh, it's kind of weird that, you know, people are going to pay hundreds of dollars a night to stay here and it's named for, you know, Jane Addams. So, you know, time will tell. It'll be interesting to see what the reaction to it is as they start making the changes and rolling this out.
Yeah, there's so many things named after people who you don't know or you don't think are worthy. So certainly you could say, oh, Jane Addams is good to name something after her. But yeah, in your story, you have this this paragraph that sort of sums it up. While Addams was known for her work with the poor, the rebranded St. James Chicago looks to find a niche just below the city's highest priced hotels, said Aperium chief operating officer Kevin Robinson. Did people call her St. Jane, by the way?
No, I know. I've never heard Saint.
She's not a saint. And,
no.
And
let's just clarify.
I mean, that's a whole other segment that could have a problem with this, because saint is an actual thing.
Right, it's a thing. That's right, it is a thing. Having said that, if anybody...
Obviously, they're taking a little liberty in pointing out that she did some, you know, saint-like, you know,
she sure did.
Work. But no, she was not, you know, she has not achieved sainthood.
Well, it's interesting. You know, a lot of her Hull houses, of course, have disappeared. I always lament this one. If you hang out on, you know, Belmont on Broadway, just north of Belmont Avenue, what used to be the Hull House there, which is kind of a famous Chicago theater, too. Famous Door was there. Bob Sickinger did his work there. And it's now a gym. Every time I drive by there, I think of the Jane Addams Hull House. And it's, you know, I look at the climbing wall. And also on Beacon Street, there's another Hull House that's gone away. So I suppose in some ways... You know, there's the argument, there's a, you know, reasonable one that people staying there, I'm going to say, okay, so who was Jane Addams? I did some work on her once, and I was always struck by how influential she was. Like, she actually had the ear of presidents, you know, like, there's a great story about somebody following her. She had a big national reputation. I think a lot of people in Chicago think that Jane Addams is this local figure with these hope, but in fact, she had an enormous national reputation. So I guess in some ways, I suppose, right, Ryan, that if you're making a hotel, the first thing you want is not to upset anybody, right? You don't want to name it, particularly right now, you don't want to name it after somebody where it's going to be a negative.
It's
right?
Not the Balbo Hotel.
Right. What do you think about that? Do you think
that
these guys are
their second choice?
You think these guys are running scared a little bit, and they're like, "Oh, Jane Addams, nobody can object to her," kind of thing.
Yeah, I don't know if that was part of the thinking, but there's certainly been a lot of conversation about what should be named after who and in what ways we should be remembering our history, even the bad parts, you know, as well as the good parts, and.
Right.
And this timing coincides with that. I don't know if that was part of their thinking at all. I didn't ask them about that.
Right.
But, you know, it's I suppose it's possible.
Right. That's why most hotels go with the wit, you know, the maple tree or something like that, because they just sort of duck that part of it altogether.
It's like Hard Rock. So I think of Hard Rock as a pretty solid brand, right? Wherever you go,
not upscale.
Is that right?
Well, I think of it as like, you know, where you're going to stay when you go to Universal Studios in Orlando or something like that.
Is that right, Ryan? You think it's not an upscale brand that people at Hard Rock is... I mean, maybe it's tired. It used to be upscale.
But if you go to the Hard Rock Cafe, that's not upscale. You got a bunch of guitars all over the place. It's sort of like... It's kind of like dressing in fancy rock and roll clothes, but it's not, you know...
What do you think, Ryan? Is an upscale...
Do
you see Hard Rock sale? Is Hard Rock getting tired as a brand, period?
Yeah, I don't know if it's getting tired. I don't know if their thinking was that it's getting tired. I think they're just really trying to capture this interest in sort of more boutique kind of experiences and unique kind of properties, and you know, you can go, you can stay in a Hard Rock Hotel in a lot of cities, and I think to their thinking, you can only stay in, you know, this hotel and in this landmark building, you know, in one place.
There's only one St. Jane, right?
There's only one St. Jane, or there may not be any, actually.
Right. And then, yeah, and you're this sort of like little boutique hotel neighborhood at this point, too, right, with a London House just down the street.
Yeah, well, that's the other thing is, you know, it's been almost a decade and a half since they converted that building into the Hard Rock.
Yeah, and you can tell.
And that location is a lot stronger location for a hotel than it was at the time. And yeah, these other unique properties like the London House, you know, a block away, and farther south, you know, the Chicago Athletic Association, and you know, the Virgin Hotel came into Chicago in an interesting old building. So, you know, there's definitely repurposing kind of old buildings into hotels and giving them a story and a unique experience has seemed to succeed. And so, you know, I think they're gonna throw their hat in the ring and see what happens.
Well, we'll have to follow up with you, Ryan, and see how much Jane Addams is actually in the St. Jane Chicago. You know, we'll see what the St. Jane honeymoon suite looks like and that sort of thing. So we'll have to follow up with you on that. But thanks so much for your reporting and coming on with us. We really appreciate
it. Thanks, Ryan.
No problem.
Welcome back to The Download. It's Mark Caro here with Chris Jones.
How you doing?
Filling in for Justin Kaufman. And you recognize whose theme that is, Chris Jones?
Sounds like Mr. Rocky.
Rocky who?
Balbo.
Rocky Balbo. all right. It's
what is this, a quiz?
Well, no. It's like I was looking for a song with Balbo, and you know, the closest I could get had, you know, Balboa. So, all right. It doesn't really fit. But we did want to talk about Balbo. You got a you got a monument there. You got a drive there.
You got a drive.
Named
there.
After an Italian fascist.
Right.
This comes up every few years. This has come up. I mean, you could look back. I mean, there are other stories, columns that have written about this over the years, where people say, "Why?" People from out of town, people from Europe, come in and they go, "Why Balbo? Why is this here?" And of course, we just think of it as like, "All right, yeah, sure, of course." You know, Monroe, Jackson, Balbo. Those are the ways you get off of Lakeshore Drive. But you know, now there's a sort of like, there's a lot of sort of monument talk. So is this the end of Balbo? What do you think, Chris?
Well, I guess there are three solutions here, right? As always, I see all sides of this, and I think there are three solutions or three ideas to posit. Number one, you say, look, it's the history. He's there. He's always been there. We know it's Balbo Drive. It's part of it. Is what it is. It was 1933 or whatever it was. What the heck? It's been there. We leave it alone. That's number one. Number two is you say, no. Okay, when we create monuments, we make a statement about values. We don't want, you know, a fascist up there. We don't, you know, okay, in 1933, people had their reasons, but we really don't need a fascist organizer like Italo Balbo to be honored in our city. So it should be taken down or removed in some way, which, of course, is the same argument that's being used for the Confederate monuments.
Exactly.
That in other words, that they just don't, you know, they don't represent the values of the moment. And in the case of the Confederate monuments, there's an argument that they were put up for sort of intimidating reasons. And many of those Confederate monuments that are being debated have a sort of a history in the Jim Crow era. And I truly think this is true, were used to intimidate African Americans. So therefore, it's like, okay, enough is enough. Take this down. We can all think of loads of people who we should be honoring more than Mr. Balbo.
So you don't have the intimidation factor here. Like that wasn't...
Well, it depends on what your view of Italian fascists is. I mean, there are people who would say that Italian fascists by definition are intimidating. Okay, maybe not as famously as intimidating as the Confederacy or even Hitler, but nonetheless intimidating to some people.
Right. The Jim Crow thing, though, is a more powerful, visceral,
yes,
like,
agreed,
you know, to that population as opposed to whatever population would have seen Balbo at the time.
Agreed.
Or certainly would see it now, because, I mean, that it's just a couple, you know, it's something that sounds like a hobbit to most people, right?
Balbo.
You know,
Balbo Baggins.
Balbo Biggins.
Balbo Biggins.
You know, a lot of, I mean, most people see the names of, you know, the streets, which more people know the street than know the monument, and they don't know who it stands for.
It's a pretty prominent street, though.
It's a very prominent street. It's right in
the Blackstone Theater on it, among other things.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's right along, and the Hilton, too, right?
Yeah.
And again, there aren't that many streets that cut all the way through to Lakeshore Drive, so that's one of the exits on Lakeshore Drive. So it's there, but it's there as a street name of someone, you know. But yeah, when people learn about it, it's a little bit like, of all the people to honor. I mean, you have all the presidents, and then you got Balbo.
So the third solution is what, let's call it, you know, for these highfalutin WGN listeners, let's just call it contextualization, which is basically an argument that the sculptor Kerry James Marshall made last night, actually, because he got one of those big City of Chicago, you know, Freedom of the City kind of fifth star awards. And he basically argued that what you should do with these statues is not take them down, but provide contextualization. So, you know, he was actually talking about having the mutilated body of Mussolini hanging upside
down. I saw that.
With his girlfriend inside the statue. So in other words, and it's, of course, another argument that's also being used in the Confederate statue debate, if you like, the idea that, okay, these statues have, if you look at Stone Mountain, for example, outside Atlanta in Georgia, which everybody agrees, you know, is a bunch of Confederate heroes carved into the side of a mountain. A lot of people in culture, such as probably you and I, I'm guessing, would be included in this. You do for a second go, okay, there's something a little queasy about erasing something like that, which is not to say that you don't understand why it should be erased. So the argument sometimes gets made, what about adding explanation or contextualization in some way? So what do you think about that? Should you take the statue and sort of say, oh, this is a, no, but this is
a, that's a lot of work, though. I mean, to have this Balbo statue and then have your, you know, your victims of Italian fascism there, and, you know, just sort of looking around. I mean, normally when you're walking around parks and you just see, oh, look, there's Lincoln in Lincoln Park. Why this? I understand why he's there. Or there's Goethe near Goethe Street. Go figure. But or not near that street. But, you know, you have the figures are there because you think that they're significant to the city and to the people of the city, and to sort of recontextualize it to make it some sort of a ugly. There's a little bit of
true.
Walking in the park to see. Do you want to see when you're walking in the park? I don't know.
But I mean, the issue is though is that
I understand why you would do it.
The issue is that a lot of people that we make statues of, or indeed we name parks after, like say Washington Park, for example, are complex figures. So, okay, are you going to say that anybody...
Washington's a complex figure?
Well, absolutely. For a lot of people, I mean, there's been this talk about renaming Washington Park because of, you know, slaves and those sorts of issues. So, I mean, there's an argument that almost anybody who you create a memorial for is, you know, none of us are perfect, none of us, and we all are products of our time, right? So this is the other issue that I think is part of this, is that all statues come from a particular period of time. And so the argument then gets to how do you deal with that? How are you honest to the time and at the same time not offend people? And I think there is a legitimate, you know, I guess I'm in favor of taking down the Confederate statues because I think they are, you know, as was said in New Orleans.
They're a relic of a...
And they're offensive. But of course, if you're going to go through the entire history of the nation and start saying, oh, well, this person did this or this person did that...
It's a slippery slope.
You might end up with very few statues that actually stay on their plinth, so to speak.
But would you mourn the absence of Balbo?
I would not mourn the absence of Balbo. I always find Balbo a weird drive because I'm always like, you've got these sort of presidential streets.
I know, that's what I was saying. Like, you're like going, yeah, you know, like, all those, and there's like Balbo. And then, like, then Roosevelt again. It's like, well, what the heck?
Right. What
Wait, why
Balbo?
Is Balbo in between, you know, Jackson and, you know,
and it always
Roosevelt
kind of jars me. I always go, honey, let's get off at Balbo. And you're like, really? Balbo? It's a sort of a, you know, it's a strange sort of thing in some ways. But, you know, and it
rolls off the tongue in kind of a fun way, too.
It does.
Like
it
I said, it's Hobbit-like. Balbo.
I have to tell you my quick Hobbit story.
Oh, good.
Please. Let me tell you my Hobbit story. Yes. I was once, I'm a man of shorter stature, and I was once in Toronto, and I was reviewing The Lord of the Rings in Toronto, and I went to a special menswear store in Toronto for men of shorter stature like myself. And I said to the guy who owns the store, I said, how's business? He says, it's great. All the hobbits are coming in.
Did he think you were a hobbit?
I think he did think
I don't think of
hobbit.
You as a hobbit.
I think he was a hobbit.
I don't think of you as an orc, but I don't think of you as a hobbit.
So I think we've now reduced Balbo to a hobbit, which is probably not a bad thing for Italian fascists.
If Balbo were if it were Bilbo, maybe they could just change one letter, and then people would be okay. I think people would be fine getting off of Lakeshore Drive on Bilbo. I think that would not be a problem, and you could play Leonard Nimoy's The Ballad of Bilbo Baggins. And that could sort of play out of that monument, and you just put a little Elijah Wood. No, it's not Elijah Wood. It would be, was it Ian Holm?
Yeah, he's built. That's right. That's right. Yeah,
anyway,
that's right.
Yeah, and then Martin Freeman. Anyway, okay, we've gone.
I do predict that Balbo will be gone. I'm just saying this on WGN.
All right,
I think
so
it's gone. Toast.
Well, Balbo will be gone by the time St. Jane.
By the time St. Jane
honeymoon
opens.
Suite it opens. All right, we have to go to commercial. We will be right back on The Download on WGN Chicago.
They call me baby.
Hello and welcome back to The Download. This is Mark Caro here with Chris Jones.
Hi, everybody.
That's Baby Driver. That was one of the most popular sort of surprise, or not such a surprise, hit of the summer. It's a movie that's going to come out later in the year, and I think it did so well at film festivals like South by Southwest, I think it was, that they moved it up to the summer. It did great. It was a popular movie. And now we have the festival season upon us. You have Cannes in May, you have South by Southwest in March, you got Sundance way back in January, but now it's the dense pack. You have Telluride, you have Toronto, you have Venice in between. And this is really the time where, if you're paying attention to this sort of thing, which I do you, Chris Jones?
Yeah,
like
a little bit.
You sort of look at, it's like when you start hearing about, these are the movies that are going to be the ones that you're going to want to see at the end of the year. Like La La Land comes out of this.
Right.
Brokeback Mountain, another year.
This is the A-list moment.
This is the moment where you've sort of gotten all that summer junk out of your system, and now it's time for the nourishment. And we have on the line with us Jeff Wells of the Hollywood Elsewhere blog. It's hollywood-elsewhere.com. I find this a compulsively readable blog. I have been reading him for so many years and so many different incarnations, and it's exciting to have you on. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, man. It's appropriate, being from Los Angeles, that I am not at my desk calmly referring to my notes and my laptop as I speak to you, but I'm on Beverly Boulevard negotiating traffic. So this will be a really interesting.
Well, if you burst into song, we will completely understand and we will enjoy it even. So, I know the sequel to La La Land is going to star you, and I hope it starts filming tonight.
And remember, all that love that was shown to Baby Driver, South by Southwest is a notoriously easy festival when it comes to genre stuff.
Right.
It's very geek heavy, and if you show them something that's got a little energy, a little verve, a little edge, they go nuts for it.
Are you trying to say it's dominated by geek space? It's a geek fest? Is that kind of the...
Yeah.
But there is that phenomenon of the festival hit. And, you and I have seen that at Sundance, especially, where, everyone goes crazy for a movie up in the thin air. And then when it opens, it's like, eh. But Baby Driver really did deliver on that enthusiasm, don't you think?
Yes, it did until the last 15 minutes or so. Then it absolutely lost its mind and went off the rails.
Well, it did the action movie thing.
It was insane. I hated it the last, but I was so into it. I loved that it was basically a bank robbing musical that really felt like it had something new to say. It was really had its own style. I was really into it. And then it blew itself up at the end. So.
Well, it does do that action movie thing where it goes on too long and the bad guy keeps coming back. And it is like the sort of, I find that with a lot of movies. I mean, Wonder Woman had that too. I really enjoyed Wonder Woman. But sometimes you're like, okay, now here are the obligatory beats they have to have in this movie, even though the movie is sort of showing how it's not really one of those movies. It still has to have it's really one of those movies moments, especially toward the end.
You feel like you're in prison. Like, here we go. We're straitjacket. We have to go to the thing that they all believe they have to deliver. Because the hardcore genre fans want this kind of thing at the end. So the big explosions, the mano a manos, all that stuff that we've seen 10,000 times has to happen. So it's a shame, but that's the way the machine, if you will, is made. Hollywood's like that.
So for like a real movie fan, how was the summer? Was it a good summer or was it a bad summer?
There are no good summers. Something you get through, and then it's over, and thank God, and then things start to happen with the Venice and particularly Telluride. And
what was the best? What was the best movie of the summer in your mind?
Boy, you tell me. I don't know.
You like Dunkirk a lot.
Dunkirk.
You like The Big Sick?
Yes, I did like that. I was actually very pleased with that. In fact, that's one of the few movies I would say this year that I've seen it three times, and it actually got a little bit better each time. I wasn't doing cartwheels when I first saw it, but I liked it. And then the second time, I went, hey, that was a little better than I remember.
Wait, you're talking about Big Sick?
Yeah, Big Sick. Yeah,
yeah, no, I enjoyed that a lot. I didn't enjoy that it was took place in Chicago and obviously was not filmed here. And then the whole thing was, hey, let's get out of Chicago. but of course, it's a true story, so I can't really deny it. But I enjoyed it a lot.
I kind of felt that she was a little too hard on him. I don't think it's exactly a state secret that guys who are part of Middle Eastern families, they're very beholden to traditions, and the mothers really run things as far as the perspective. Wives are concerned. It's a very deeply embedded thing. So it's not exactly a betrayal to have entertained, gone through the motions of meeting women under the guise of your mother, you know. So it's not I thought she got too angry and she wouldn't give it up. But other than that, it was a very good film.
Yeah. Well, people in movies don't conform to how we want them to behave necessarily. That's they're flawed in their own ways.
So, you know, I'm dying to know. So what, like, so obviously it's coming to fall, right? So things, the summer that you don't like is about to disappear. And we're getting into this, as Mark says, this prime movie going season. So come Oscar time. So what are the movies, right, that we have not yet seen here in Chicago, that we've not had the chance to see, that you think are going to be, you know, they're nominated for the best movie Oscar? What are the hottest films? If you were to say, okay, right now, I'm going to stake my considerable reputation on this, what are the movies that we're going to be talking about, let's say, in December? What would you say they are?
Without a doubt, it's going to be one of them is going to be Luca Guadagnino's Call Me By Your Name, which was a huge hit at Sundance last January. It was, if you look at the Rotten Tomatoes, it's got 100% rating.
Yeah.
It is.
What's it about? What's it about that movie?
It's a gay love story set in northern Italy, but it's not so much a gay love story. It's a kind of a bi thing, and it's not really so much a love story as it is a sensual kind of dream trip in northern Italy with wonderful food and sunlight and swimming and. It makes you feel like you're in northern Italy yourself, laying back.
One of the
very engaging, and it has a wonderfully touching finale that will probably result in Michael Stolberg getting a Best Supporting Actor nomination.
One of the things I really enjoy about your blog, which is, again, Hollywood-Elsewhere.com. We're on with Jeff Wells on WGN Radio Chicago with me, Mark Caro, and there, Chris Jones. Yep. One of the things I really enjoy about it is that you will see these things at festivals and give really an immediate response to how you reacted to it, how other people reacted to it. And that was a festival film also where I remember you were like, oh, I'm over the moon on this one, right?
Yeah.
Is this
Sundance?
Is this a mainstream film, Jeff? Is this a film that's like you say it's going to be, obviously you think it's going to be an Oscar contender. Is it going to do well? Is it a film that's got broad appeal?
What you mean is, our ticket buyers going to go for
right.
it? Are middle of the road people going to go for
yes.
it? And that's the question mark. I don't think it's too gay. I think it's like gay. I don't know what that means. It means it's kind of gayish, but it's not.
It
certainly doesn't hit you over the head with it.
Right.
It goes easy.
Right.
And I didn't think, you know, now I know a couple of guys roughly my age, which is to say somewhat, you know, leaning towards boomerish age, and they kind of had. They thought it was a little too strong for them. I didn't think so. I thought it was just. No, it was more about the taste of wine and apples and peaches and what it's like to swim in a pond, that kind of thing.
Right.
It's not a sensual thing, but it's. But maybe older guys, maybe popcorn eaters are going to have maybe a little bit of.
All right. So what else? Come on. So that's one. That's on my list now. So what else? What else is going to be competing?
Woody Allen's film Wonder Wheel, the word is, and this is from the people who have seen it within the prism of the New York Film Festival, is that it's, every four or five films, he really hits a long ball.
Yeah.
It's apparently one of those four or five. maybe.
And you wrote that Jim Belushi is getting hyped for that one.
That's what definitely came from two people.
Chicago's very own.
They even said that Jim Belushi is stronger, or the one that you remember more than Kate Winslet, who everybody has been saying, well, she, that looks like a great performance.
What's it about? Like, so what's the movie about? What's this Woody Allen, this hot Woody Allen movie then that he's going to come, Woody Allen's going to come roaring back with?
Kate is married to Jim Belushi. It's the early 50s, Coney Island area, Brooklyn. Mm. And she is having an affair with Justin Timberlake, who's younger than she. And she's really in love, and it's the only thing that gives her life any you know, force and dimension and vivacity. And what happens is that he starts to drop her and fall in love with somebody else, and she falls apart. And Jim Belushi has to kind of weather the storm of his wife having, you know, been unfaithful.
So he's kind of
Justin Timberlake. I understand. You know, Justin Timberlake could cause problems for a lot of us, I think.
Yeah, what else? Come on, that's good. That's two. What else? This is great. You know, this is great. You're doing great radio for us here. What else? What are the other hot movies?
The big excitement, in fact, the one that's going to open tomorrow night at Venice, is Alexander Payne's Downsizing, which is a futuristic kind of a Fritz Lang-like tale in which people have agreed in the future to have themselves reduced to the size of a pinky finger. That way, their money will go a lot farther.
Wait! A pinky finger, like the like a little. So it's Honey, I Shrunk Myself kind of thing.
Yes.
Oh,
they're literally being downsized, Chris.
Like 18 inches.
They're all becoming hobbits.
They're shrunk down to 2.5 to 3 inches tall, and the money. Say you have $10,000 in your bank account. If you're only the size of your pinky finger, that money will be much more potent for you, and you'll be able to live much better and have a great, much richer lifestyle.
The whole world is people of this size? So this is sort of some people are shrunk and some people are full size?
Some people decide they want to because it's advantageous. They're going to leave a much smaller carbon footprint.
Right.
I saw a couple movies over the weekend, and I was watching the trailers, and it's like I knew that I was coming in on the season because I was like, oh yeah, I want to see that movie. So I saw a trailer for Suburbicon, which is the one that George Clooney directed that is based on, it was originally a Joel and Ethan Coen screenplay, right?
In fact, if you look at that, what the setup there is, it's somewhat similar to Fargo. They kind of wrote Fargo in 85, I think it's when they wrote the script, or 86, and then they remade it as Fargo. But it's got a lot of the same elements.
So Matt Damon is Bill Macy, basically. And then Oscar Isaac is Francis McDormand?
That's exactly it. As far as I can see, yes. I heard from a guy who saw it last summer and told me all about it.
And liked it?
Yeah, he thought it was okay. He thought the second half wasn't as strong as the first, but, you know, that's hearsay.
All right, so we got...
It's going to be reviewed in detail as of tomorrow night.
So we got four. That's four, right? We got the Woody Allen. We got the Shrunk, Honey, I Shrunk, I'm a Pinky Finger. What else am I missing? There's the...
I'm looking forward to Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri by Martin McDonagh, who's a playwright you know.
Have you seen that?
The word on that one is that it's good, but not necessarily knocked down great.
No, the trailer's knocked down great, though, don't you think?
Yeah, no, it looks like she's going to be wonderful just alone for her performance, but I just have heard, and I really want to stress that. I don't know anything. I'm just telling you that what's coming across is good, but don't do, you know, not necessarily cartwheel great. Right.
So what is the Oscar goes to which movie?
Oh, well, I haven't mentioned the Spielberg film.
Oh, yeah, go on. Give us that. Give us that Pentagon one. Give us the full story on that one. Come on.
Well, that's the story, basically, of Katharine Graham, the publisher of the Washington Post back in 71, who was kind of a caretaker publisher, and she was reluctant to really exert any control or any guidance. And she got caught up, along with Ben Bradley and all the other senior people at the Post, in the Pentagon Papers thing, and after the New York Times published, they also wanted to publish, the Post did, and they were challenged by the Nixon administration, and it wound up going to the Supreme Court. So it's basically about a woman who is reluctant to be a professional, to be a publisher with a serious journalistic backbone, and she grows a backbone, if you will, over the course of the game.
And who's right. Who's in that?
Hanks and Streep, right?
Played by Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Meryl Streep is Katharine Graham.
So this is the
So it's very high prestige. Yeah. I'll be curious how the New York Times responds to this, though, because there's this feeling that the New York Times was actually, you know, look, the Washington Post had Watergate, but the New York Times had the Pentagon Papers. And now here's Steven Spielberg giving the Pentagon Papers to the Washington Post also. So this is going to be more controversial in journalistic circles, I think, than Spotlight was.
Well, as I said, and triumphant thing the Post did in being the second paper to publish the paper about what Katharine Graham went through.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that must humanize it. But it's like, it's interesting, these films, you know, we journalists are kind of, we're kind of reliant on Hollywood every year or two with Spotlight and whatnot to sort of venerate the role of the journalist and to remind people that, you know, without great newspapers like the Post and the Times and the Globe, that none of these, you know, these past corruptions would never have come to light. And Hollywood is clearly sort of in a sympathetic mode toward journalists, right, Jeff?
Yeah, I mean,
you're breaking up a little bit there. You got to drive into a better part of the valley or wherever you are. But I do appreciate, but it makes it more authentically LA.
Mark,
yes.
I've been just thinking to myself that apart from the Oscar cavalcade, I think that a lot of people are going to be talking about and want to see Our Souls at Night. It's called the Robert Redford, Jane Fonda.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Romance. And that's going to be it. And it's also, that'll be screening on Friday, this coming Friday, and the reviews will be out the same day. And I hear that's pretty good. There's no problems with that, and it's actually quite well performed, and it's quite likable. So I don't know if it's going to be, A-plus reviews or whatever, but I think it's going to be well-liked. And I think, you know, there's kind of a thing about wanting to see those two again, because they've been in three movies previously. They weren't romantically paired in The Chase, but they were romantically paired in Barefoot in the Park and Electric Horses. So this is a kind of a nice closing act for them, if you will.
I think there's a real feeling also of, you know, people wanting to see Robert Redford get his due. I mean, I thought he was wonderful in All Is Lost and was disappointed he didn't get the nomination for that. But he's done so much for independent film. And frankly, independent film has come to really dominate the Oscars anyway. I could definitely see him, you know, if he has a performance that is, you know, really credible, and it's one of those years where they're not going to give it to someone else, obviously, I could definitely see him in the running if he pulls it off. Don't you think?
Yes, except that I hear it's more of an easy does it, goes down easy movie with very human and resonant feelings that touch you, rather than something that really amounts to something that's really, you know, top grade.
Would you put On Golden Pond in that category too?
Yes, I would, actually. I didn't mind that film at all. I mean, I didn't. I would never call it a great film, but I thought it was actually a pretty appealing film, particularly Henry Fonda's performance, given that I think that was his last role, as I remember.
Yeah. Right. Is there a movie, hey Jeff, is there a movie that Hollywood's going to lose its shirt on that everyone's like spending a ton of money on that you think is just going to tank and just going to cause people to lose their jobs and be upset? And is there a big disaster waiting for us in the fall, do you think?
I don't think there's anything that's really rock'em sock'em. I'm sorry, but it just doesn't happen to be that kind of year.
Yeah.
Maybe, possibly The Greatest Showman, as far as people that just want to have a good time.
That's the Hugh Jackman film?
Yeah, as P.T. Barnum, and that's a full-out musical, more in the traditional mode. It's not a La La Land type musical.
Right.
It's the kind of thing that maybe Mervyn LeRoy could have directed back in the 50s.
Yeah.
It sounds kind of...
iffy? You know, you're iffy on that? You're iffy on it?
I shouldn't say iffy. I know that it looks and sounds great, and the presentation at CinemaCon last March was first rate, and everybody came away thinking, well, that's going to be something. That's going to be a major film that people are going to get very excited. So in terms of like people saying, wow, I really like that one. Probably one of those films, maybe.
He was tweeting about it. I follow Hugh Jackman on Twitter, and he was all about it today, in fact. He was kind of, you know, and the other thing about P.T. Barnum, I guess these great aphorisms about, you know, life and man, you know, maybe, I don't know, but it sounds like it's not entirely convinced.
It just looks square.
Yeah, he doesn't see it. So, Jeff, where are you going to be for, you know, in the next coming weeks?
Yeah. I also think you got to watch out for Roman Israel, Roman J. Israel Esquire, which is a Denzel Washington drama, which is going to be, they haven't officially announced it, but it's going to be at Toronto, I believe.
So are you going to Telluride, Jeff?
Yes, I am. I'm leaving tomorrow.
And then are you going to Toronto also, or just Telluride, you just get everything that you need?
Yes, Toronto directly after Telluride.
All right. So, we are looking forward to reading you on HollywoodElsewhere.com, Hollywood-Elsewhere.com. Again, it's like you could get on there multiple times a day, and you get the best comments boards, too. You just get these strings, and sometimes people are, you know, poking at you. Sometimes people are praising you, but it's a very lively community that you've created over there at HollywoodElsewhere.com. So
The back and forth is what I really love about that, about writing it, and I love the arguments, and I love the put downs, the whole thing. Oh, by one more thing.
Okay.
Guillermo del Toro's best film in a long time is supposedly called The Shape. It is called The Shape of Water, but it's supposedly a really exceptional film, and it has a superb performance, I'm told, by Sally Hawkins, who's basically doing a Jane Wyman and Johnny Belinda. No dialogue at all.
Oh, wow.
All right, looking forward to that. We will keep reading you, Jeff Wells, Mark Caro, and Chris Jones on The Download. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to The Download. This is that's Chris Jones singing City. No, that's Ryan Gosling singing City of Stars, the way
an actor who isn't a musical theater guy
would sing it. This is Mark Caro. That is Chris Jones laughing over there. We're filling in for Justin Kaufman on The Download, and very happy to be with you here on WGN Radio Chicago. So, yeah, it's that time of the season. So we just finished talking to Jeff Wells of Hollywood Elsewhere. And, you know, this is where all the... If you like following movies, and this probably happens, you know, in your sense too, except, you know, theater's a more local thing, but, you know, you have Telluride Film Festival is just about to start. You have Venice just about to start, I think, tomorrow. You have the Toronto Film Festival. Chicago Film Festival is coming up. New York Film Festival. Chicago used to be one where they used to try to kind of break all these films. You know, they would try to introduce, you know, the new hot film, but they just couldn't do it. So now it's really kind of a best of stuff that's played at other festivals.
Sort of a consumer festival, as they say.
More for people who live in Chicago and less for people who are going to come to Chicago and write about how influential it is, which is a change that happened about 20 years ago because I was writing about it then, and it probably was for the better for the city as far as that festival goes.
But a shame if you're a sort of industry pundit like yourself, right? I mean,
well,
not as influential.
It's not as important for sure. But Toronto is so exhaustive, and Telluride has a lot of the same stuff, and it's just this cluster of stuff that's in the fall. You know, you'd have to move Chicago to some other time of the year, but you know, like South by Southwest now pretty much is staked out March, and you wouldn't want to come to March. Although you could see movies in March because you don't have anything else better to do then. But it's just a different sort of thing. But I think that it's interesting because people talk about the Oscars and people tend to fixate on the ratings of the show. And I'm going to argue the maybe contrary point that the Oscars have actually gotten better because there's more of a correlation between the movies that the critics, and I would consider myself one, you know, in spirit, if not, you know, actually working as one at the time, what the Oscars reward. I mean, a lot of times you would get to the end of the year and there would be these big prestige movies that the studios would put a lot of money into that weren't that good and they would just be there. Whereas last year's Oscars, I mean, these past Oscars, I can't think of a year in which, you know, maybe the top five movies were all movies I would have been happy to see win. And it all kind of coincided with the, you know, a lot of people's top 10 lists. I mean, you had Moonlight, you had, you know, La La Land, you had Hell or High Water. You know, these were all, Arrival was a really good movie. So, you know, there were only a few that I didn't think really worked. So I think the batting average has gotten better, and so I'm happy to see these movies get this attention through festivals and elsewhere.
Well, is it true now that the festival, you know, we used to think of festivals as sort of more mainstream festivals, and then your more alternative, your art house festivals, that distinction, right, has completely disappeared, that there's... The arty and the mainstream are all one thing now, it seems.
Well, in the mainstream, the thing is that the studios have gotten out of the prestige mainstream business. They really are in the superhero movie business. I mean, you just look at what all their big movies, you know, the tent poles, what they call them.
Right.
I mean, these are, you know, possible theme park rides, and that's what the studios are doing. And so they've kind of ceded this whole category of stuff to the independents. So, Like, I remember you wrote about how, you know, between Moonlight and La La Land, La La Land was kind of the Hollywood, you know, sort of entry in that game. But even that was such an odd movie for Hollywood. It did have some stars in it, but it's a retro, you know, musical that's sort of like The Umbrellas of Cherbourg more than it's like Singing in the Rain. And no studio is going to make La La Land thinking they're going to make a lot of money. And so the studios aren't in that business anymore. And so the independents are doing well, and they get a little more of a ride for it because they have that territory to themselves.
Well, I suppose it's a global matter for the studios, right? That these big movies you're talking about make a fortune globally, right? Which was some of these other films that we're excited that we were just talking about with Jeff Wells. They're not necessarily movies that are going to have global audiences, whereas the studios figured out that the real money is to be made overseas.
Right. And then you get something like The Post, which is Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep. And that's certainly going to be, you know, a big studio entry in this whole race. And then the question will be whether it's actually good and whether people like it, which still does matter on all of that.
So what do you think of that one? Is it going to go? Are you handicapping The Post?
Jeff does a lot.
If you're a journalist, you kind of want it to be good, right?
I want every movie to be good, Chris. I want them all to be good. I even want the Pirates of the Caribbean. No, I don't really want the Pirates of the Caribbean 5th movie to be good. I don't care. I don't care about the latest Michael Bay. But in general, you want these movies that come out with a lot of expectation to turn around and, I mean, I'd rather go see a good movie than not a good movie.
Yeah, sure.
I think that when you sort of start off like reviewing stuff, sometimes you just sort of root for something to be bad so you could show how smart, you know, you can be and how funny you can be. But after a while, you're like, nah, I just want everything to be good because it's just more fun to actually have some quality to celebrate. And, you know, the country needs some good art right now. So, you know, let us unify about something like decent cinematic quality.
It's going to be a lot of Denzel Washington coming up. I was interested to hear about that Roman Israel Esquire. And then, of course, he's also got a Broadway show. He's going to do The Iceman Cometh.
Right, I saw that.
Broadway.
Is that Bob Falls?
No, that is not Bob Falls. That is, in fact, that's George C. Wolfe. It's a different production. It could have been Bob Falls, but they made a different decision in New York City to go. Scott Rudin, the producer of that, has held the rights to The Iceman Cometh on Broadway for a long time. He, you know, the other show went to the one, The Iceman Cometh, that was here at the Goodman a couple of years ago, went to BAM, Brooklyn Academy of Music, but never went to Broadway. And Denzel Washington has been looking around, I know, for a play that he wants to do next. He did Raisin in the Sun, right. big hit. The Obamas came. It was kind of a great moment for him. And he's decided to do Iceman Cometh, which is interesting. You know, it's a very long play. It's difficult to produce because it's so long, and it's difficult to do 8 shows a week. But it's, you know, Denzel gets to do whatever Denzel wants to do, and he's a genuine star, and he should.
Do you see him in that role, Chris?
I do, actually. I think it's a better role for him than Walter was in Raisin in the Sun, for which, frankly, he's a little old. Whereas this, Hickey, he's right in the, he's kind of in the sweet spot for Hickey. That should be, of all the shows next season on Broadway, you know, you've got the new Steve Martin play with Amy Schumer that's coming up. You've got the Band's Visit, which is directed by Chicago's own David Cromer, that's also coming this fall on Broadway. And then in the spring, Broadway goes insane because you've got Harry Potter, which is insane. I saw it in London. It's fabulous. I mean, I won't hear a word against it. You know, it is what it is. It'll be a phenomenon. It'll be
We should see that together.
It'll be great.
It'd be great. So, thank you, Chris, for inviting me.
Yeah, it's a tough ticket, Mark.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate it.
And then you've got Frozen. So Disney, and then Disney rolling the dice. In fact, that's opening, it's in performances now, actually, in Denver, the tryout for Frozen, which has to
not be, here.
No, in Denver, Colorado, going up against Harry Potter, basically. Frozen's an interesting one because, you know, there's the question with Frozen, A, you've got high expectations of that, and then you've also got, you know, the question of are you going to see Frozen without a kid? One of the keys to Disney's hits, certainly in the live stage sense, is adult audiences. You know, date people go to Lion King. You on a date, maybe you might even go to Aladdin right here in Chicago one more week, folks. But Frozen, are you going without a kid? I don't know. So that's, you know, if it's really great, maybe you will. So that's, you know, they're dealing with that. And they're also up against Harry Potter when, believe me, you are going without a kid. So that's going to be very interesting in the spring. So Denzel's getting in there before all that. And he's going to have a good year. I think that Roman Israel looks kind of cool. Colin Farrell's in that, too. It looks like a kind of a cool movie.
Now, when you say that Frozen is up against Harry Potter. I mean, it's one thing when you have a blockbuster movie that's opening in 5,000 theaters against another movie that's in 5,000 theaters or 4,000 theaters. But you're talking about a play, a musical that's in one theater. I mean, they're both going to sell out anyway, right? Does one detract from the other?
I think there's an argument on Broadway that there's only so many family shows that can do well. So, for example, right now you're seeing a real renaissance. So there's a show on Broadway, Anastasia, based on the animated movie.
Right.
It's not a great show. It's not a great show. It's not a bad show. It's not terrible. It's not great. It got sort of mixed reviews. I thought it was okay, mostly. Right. So that was kind of my feeling on it. But it's doing $900,000, $1 million a week on Broadway because it's found an audience, mostly a mother and daughter audience the night I was there, which is a big, big part of Broadway's audience.
Are you surprised by that?
I am surprised. I think everybody thought it would be closed. I think if you'd said to most theater critics, would Groundhog Day close and Anastasia be running, they would have said, no way. Everybody thought Groundhog Day was going to be a bigger hit than Anastasia. And in fact, Groundhog Day is closing. Groundhog Day
as
a live show has been a bit of a flop. And my theory...
And it was well received.
Yes.
Not amazingly, but well received.
Yes. Some of us had a few... yes.
Well, then why is it surprised? If it's not that great, why are you so surprised that it's closing?
My theory on Groundhog Day is that it's a great book. It's a great screenplay, and it's a great book of a musical. Because most time travel narratives, Mark Caro, in my not so humble opinion, get too complex, and you sit there... And you go, oh, but that leads to that, which leads to that. Groundhog Day is very good because it's confined. You're like, yeah, I can believe that. The day starts over. And I was just thinking about Danny Rubin's screenplay from Chicago.
Right.
And it's a great screenplay, but it's a fairly crap production of that screenplay. That's my view of Groundhog Day.
See, I always wondered about Groundhog Day, too, because the movie, to me... is so Harold Ramis. I mean,
right.
He came and he directed it, yes, and I think he really shaped that material a lot. And... Harold Ramis and, you know, his estate was not involved in this musical at all. And so part of me sort of wonders, content-wise, I haven't seen it. Spiritually, like, does this really represent the Harold Ramis Groundhog Day that we all revere so much as a movie and everything
else? Well, the thing about Harold Ramis is, you know better than almost anybody, is he was interested in truth, right? He was interested in truth. And there's nothing true about Groundhog Day on Broadway.
All right. We're going to continue discussing... what's coming up in the fall. We're going to throw in some other little oddball stories we have coming up. And then at 9 o'clock, we're going to go to Houston and talk to some people there about what's happening in the arts and actors getting stranded in the Four Seasons and that sort of thing when we come back with The Download with Mark Caro and Chris Jones. Nestled between the towering Norway pines and perched atop the sandstone bluffs of Mirror Lake, next to Mirror Lake State Park, Wisconsin, sits a supper club like no other. Ishnala Supper Club, voted the number one supper club in Wisconsin by Travel Wisconsin and the best destination restaurant by Madison Magazine, is guaranteed to amaze you from the sheer beauty of their majestic grounds and the quaint and timeless decor to the superb quality of their delicious entrees. You'll absolutely love the breathtaking views of Mirror Lake as you sip on an old-fashioned and feast on one of their amazing entrees. You're going to get more hungry here. Filet and cold water lobster tails, and a naturally aged prime rib and butterfly prawns, or a 24-ounce ribeye steak. Order it in now from Wisconsin. Chris, you simply have to experience Ishnala Supper Club yourself to believe it. They're open May through October and located just minutes away from I-90 and 94 West in Lake Delton, Wisconsin. Visit.
Sign me up.
Visit Ishnala Supper Club tonight. It is truly the best supper club in Wisconsin. All right. We are back on The Download. WGN Radio Chicago. Chris Jones.
Hey.
And Mark Caro. That is I. And we're just talking about movies and Oscars and everything else. And, you know, just randomly speaking, apropos of nothing, Chris, I saw a little story today on people.com that involves
out on people.com.
I was kind of, just going around. I was doing some writing today. And when you're doing writing, the thing that really gets your brain to work well is when you just keep looking around at other websites of things. And I saw this headline, and this is what's known as clickbait. It really made me want to know. It said, Kristen Cavallari reveals how she keeps the spark alive with husband Jay Cutler. Do you want to know,
how does
Chris?
She keep the spark
alive? Do you want to know how you
keep... Because I always struggle to keep the spark alive.
I think a lot of Bears fans want to know how to keep the spark alive with Jay Cutler.
So, come on, tell us.
So this is sort of profound, and people in Radio Land, I hope you appreciate this, because I'm going to share with you the secret of Kristen Cavallari reveals how she keeps the spark alive with husband Jay Cutler. Quote, "I have always said it's kind of nice to miss each other," Cavallari 30 told E's Daily Pop. "I think that's how we've always kind of kept our spark alive."
Missing each other?
Yeah. Jay just signed with the Miami Dolphins, so he's in Florida. Some days it's crazy, and I can't wait for bedtime. And other days I'm like, okay, it's actually not that bad, shared Cavallari. So the way you keep the spark alive with Jay Cutler is you have him like go to another state.
So what you're saying here...
If you miss him, then you can keep the spark alive. Right. But so it's really, if you don't have him around, that's the secret to being
married. So what do you do
to
for those of us who have our lovely partners around all the time? Well, how do you keep the spark alive when you can't say, honey, spend a week in Miami, come back, we'll be sparking?
No, see, I saw this as specific to Jay Cutler. Like if like if someone needed to keep the spark alive with Jay Cutler, you just send him somewhere else. So I think it's really only about Jay Cutler and not really. It's you know, this is why it's her secret on how she keeps.
So it's a bit like the Taylor Swift song that you can't translate it to someone. It's specifically about those individuals.
And I think that that'll be true of Bears fans too, and that, you know, we'll probably appreciate him more now that he's not with us. I don't think we'll actually be wishing we're rooting for him on our team, but you know, we'll sort of enjoy seeing how he does with Miami. And so there you go with that's your little profound tip. But you know, you travel a lot, right?
Yeah.
So doesn't absence make the heart grow a little fonder for you?
I guess it does. I think there's something about, you know, coming home when you've been gone. That's a great way to keep the spark alive. I was just at the earlier this evening, I was just at the opening of Lauren Stryker's new sex clinic, actually, sexual therapy clinic.
An actual clinic.
I'm hoping to coax her on our show.
The opening of it.
As you know, we're back on the air on Thursday. We're hoping to coax Dr. Lauren to come on and talk about, really, that very question, how do you keep the spark alive? And she had a band, the Sex RX band. It was kind of a show tonight. But you might want to just tune back in on Thursday for the full story.
We should tune back. I'm going to tune back in. I'm going to be here, and I want to know.
Yeah.
So what's the answer?
Well, you just have to wait till Thursday.
Did you get any good tips at this thing?
It's a combination of things. What can we say? It's a combination of things. But a lot of it is, you know, there's something about the everyday. I mean, come on. Really, spark? You need the spark. You need to be gone to keep the spark alive. I think it's just. I like the everyday thing.
I just like how that's like the headline. Like Kristen Cavallari reveals how she keeps the spark alive with husband Jay Cutler. You think it's going to be this really deep, profound piece of news, and it's like, yeah, it's kind of nice to miss each other.
You know what? You know what headline in those
kind of nice.
You know what headline in those kind of stories I most want to ban that I would love never to read again. It's the phrase "opens up."
Breaks silence about when it's like they've just given an interview. They broke Kristen Cavallari breaks her silence about how she keeps the spark alive with husband Jay Cutler.
So essentially, you know, some celebrity's out promoting a movie, and you know the headline is, you know, Celebrity X opens up about their new role. Or there was actually a story about, you know, how an actor had to reveal something of this just in, right? Reveal something
breaking.
who they really are in order to play this role.
Right.
Opens up. It's like a click. I think it's a headline that has its historical derivation more in clickbait than it does really in the tradition of headlines, but it just gets me. I just find it the worst. Opens up. Because opens up by definition means that you want to be closed and that you are really revealing something. So the story you read would not qualify, for example. It's just a statement. You don't open up on a regular basis.
All right, well, so how would you define the phrase exclusive interview? Does that mean that this is the only interview that this person has given, or just
yes,
the interview,
yes, right
or
there.
The interview,
stop there.
Or the interview that you got is exclusive to you because there wasn't anyone else getting all the same quotes?
Exclusive interview should mean they are speaking on this. Now, granted, you know, you can get an exclusive interview with Tom Hanks, and a year later he can give me exclusive. That's fine.
So
there has to be some protocol of duration between those.
What's
two
the duration?
Things. Well, weeks, certainly. Days, weeks, but not an hour down the hall is another exclusive interview with another website.
No, but see, I think it'll often be like exclusive. Tom Hanks reveals that he likes garlic more than dill pickles or something.
Well, then it's possible to have a non-exclusive interview but have exclusive information. That's fair enough. It's, you know, but usually it's not really exclusive. And firstly, in order for it to be exclusive, here's the other thing. It has to be consequential. Like, there's no point in an exclusive that's not consequential by definition.
Are you implying that most clickbait is not consequential?
Yeah, most of what you read on people.com when you're supposed to be writing, by the way, is not consequential.
Says who? Says my boss is you? No, I don't think so. This is why I write at home. You know, Entertainment Weekly, by the way, this is going to be very useful information for all of you Game of Thrones. Do you guys watch Game of Thrones? I can hear you saying, yeah, some of us do, some of us don't. Okay, so I'm going to do this really quick. Chris Jones, are you a Game of Thrones
guy?
Yeah,
I'm like a season behind, so.
Entertainment Weekly, you know, one of the great clickbaits is ranking things. Like Bill Wyman, formerly of The Reader, ranked all of the Pink Floyd songs recently after ranking all of the Beatles songs. I think ranking songs is insane. But Entertainment Weekly did a much more user-friendly thing. They ranked the Game of Thrones seasons, and there are only seven. So I'm going to tell you right now how they rank the Game of Thrones seasons. Ready? 4, 3, 1, 6, 7, 2, 5. There you go.
Best
one was the fourth season, then the third season, then the first season, then the sixth season, then the seventh, i.e. the one that just ended on Sunday night, fifth place, second season in sixth place, and fifth season. That was the third.
It always reminds me how if you're ever on a plane, you know, and you go to the TV section on like American Airlines and it goes Game of Thrones and you're like, oh, I can watch this. And it's like episode 7. Season 5.
Exactly.
And you're like, who on a plane is watching one episode of a season 3 seasons ago? I guess they just don't want to really.
Well, if you've watched it before and you want to renew that, I don't know. All right, we're going to come back. We're going to have a little break. We'll come back. We'll do the news. And then we're going to go down to Houston and learn a lot of interesting stuff.
Good stuff coming up.
So coming right back on WGN on the download.
Well, it's lonesome in this old town. Everybody puts me down. I'm a face without a name.
You're listening to Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Hello.
Hello, this is Chris Jones. Mark Caro's right over there at the other microphone.
Hey.
And we're in for Justin Kaufman. You're listening to The Download. Mark and I here all the way through 11 o'clock. We're back on Thursday night, in case you just can't get enough of us tonight.
So I can't. I can't get enough of us right now.
So might want to make a note of that. We're honored to be here for the great Justin Kaufman. So this hour, we're going to talk about Houston. And we're going to, I hope, give you a couple of new perspectives maybe on what's going on down there that you may be not seeing on on CNN or on Fox News or anything.
Or on WGN.
Or on WGN for that matter. But, you know, what we thought we'd do is sort of talk to a couple of people who are in the sort of cultural arena a bit like us, but who are there right now and who have their eyeballs, you know, on exactly what's going on there. So joining us from Houston, from the Houston Chronicle, one of my favorite American critics, he's the theater critic. He's also the classical opera critic at the Houston Chronicle, a great journalist.
And a great opera town.
Exactly. Say hello to Wei Huan Chen. How you doing, Wei?
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Hey.
Thank you so much.
All right, so let's it's great to talk to you. You're on with Chris and Mark on WGN Radio.
Hi, Wei.
Hi.
All right, so let's start with this. Let's just start with this. So I know you understand this, that we're a long way away. We look out, we see dry streets. It is a tad remote for us here in Chicago. So I guess my first question for you is just tell us what's it like. Like, I know you live there. You've been there, I think, since 2016, right?
Yes.
What's it like on a deep level as a cultural guy? What's it like right now in Houston?
It's been a really tough blow. It's chaos right now. So just to back up a couple of days, on Sunday, the water hit such a level where, if you guys saw this video, there was a visiting playwright, Rajiv Joseph. He was there to premiere, describe the night with Alley Theater. So he takes this photo, this video of the downtown theater district, which is where Jones Hall, the Alley Theater, Wortham Center, where the opera is. Everything is under, I think, 3-4, maybe up to 5 feet of water. You can see the water going up almost beyond where the parking meters are and the stop signs are, that kind of height. And so the Alley Theater found out that their entire Newhouse Theater was drowned. And not only did the water go and sink, there were dressing rooms, there were washer dryer, their entire system is out. So right now they don't have email, they don't have any servers, they can't communicate to anyone in any way. I think they've started a private Facebook Facebook group just to communicate, but they're completely out of the count and there's no electricity. So they're just trying to figure out what are they going to do. There's a very important play with Describe the Night. They're probably going to have to move it out. Right now, the alley, I was just here, I was just downtown this afternoon. They were pumping out water out of the new house. I couldn't see where it was, but it was worse than Hurricane Allison. And the water's up to the ceiling. So the alley theaters suffered really big damage. All the other theaters had problems as well, but the alley had it the worst. And they're, you know, they're kind of like the cornerstone of the theater community here.
What about in the classical music and the whole opera world and all of that side of things?
So Jones Hall is the home of the Houston Symphony, and the main stage and the main lobby are fine. So we were lucky. And Society for Performing Arts and Houston Symphony, they have their if you go kind of to the front of this beautiful front of Jones Hall, you can actually walk down to the Houston Symphony offices. So they're a little bit below ground. They were actually okay. I think some of their carpets got damp. So Jones Hall got pretty lucky. There was a rehearsal room that was flooded, but they moved some of the instruments out of the way. So Jones Hall was luckier than the alley, which had significant basement flooding. The problem is right now, you drive to Houston and you will likely park underground, and everything underground is flooded. Houston is known for its big underground water, it's a waterway now.
Yeah.
It's completely covered in green and brown kind of sludgy water. I took a look down there. So even if you want to see the symphony and the symphony's open, you have nowhere to park. So the symphony canceled its Ella Fitzgerald celebration this weekend.
Is there anything actually going on there? Could you go into Houston and see any cultural event?
No. If you go outside of the theater district, Stages Repertory Theater is going to open up pretty soon. The Match over in downtown, which hosts, you know, our upcoming Fringe Festival and a lot of other more independent productions, is still open, time being. So nothing is confirmed right now, but there may be some performances outside of the theater district that will be going on. Everything in the theater district that I know of is completely canceled. That's all the organizations downtown.
Is there a sense that these buildings are permanently damaged? Like, in other words, are you looking here at sort of, you know, closing for years and having to rebuild? Or is this like, okay, the water will recede in a few days and it'll clear up and it'll be okay? Like, what's the mood of people there in terms of, is this temporary or is this really long-term?
If they're in the basement or below ground, they are still underwater and they're currently suffering damage. So this is what we're talking, complete renovation. Now, I didn't mention the Wortham Center, which is the home of Houston Ballet and Houston Grand Opera. Their basement levels were completely flooded. So that means it's not just, you know, the walls and the props and everything that was left down there. It's the electrical systems. It's everything kind of built in there. So I think in the coming weeks, there will be people putting a number on, you know, what is this cost? How are people going to pay for it? Everyone knows that this was worse than Allison, and Allison was viewed as a major catastrophe. Actually, if you go down to the alley theater, if it was like 2 weeks ago and you looked in the basement area, there was an Allison line, a big red line that was maybe like 3 feet above where your head would be, designated where the water was, it went way beyond that, and it's still there. I think they're pumping out water right now. Hopefully we'll have more answers to come later.
Chris and I were just talking about how the fall is really the time where you kind of get to, you know, sink your teeth into sort of the meat of the season. You know, it's all the serious stuff is coming out. Is there's certain energy about coming out of summer and really getting to experience art and culture and entertainment. Is there a sense that the fall season there is just kind of being killed right now, or is there a sense that it's just being delayed?
I mean, I don't know. We'll have to see. I mean, in a symbolic sense, the start of the fall season is the Houston Theater District open house, which sells most of the season packets, and you are seeing a preview of the fall.
You walk around there? Do you walk around? At least you used to walk around there.
Everything's open, exactly, yes. And there's free performances. I mean, there's multiple organizations involved. Well, that entire event was canceled. And if you want to buy season packages right now. Well, at the alley, you can't because everything's broken down.
Right.
At other organizations, they can, but they have to figure out how are we going to refund the first couple of weeks where their stages are still not up to par, or there's just no parking. You know, how is that parking garage going to fare in the weeks to come? So there's just so many questions out right now. So it's really hard to say when that fall season will be back in full swing, back to normal.
Right.
But right now, you know, especially for the alley, they have to reschedule to Scrub Tonight. That was, I mean, I was very looking forward to the premiere of an exciting new play at the alley. But right now, there's bigger news.
What's the mood of it? Like, what's the? I mean, I know this is an obvious question, and I apologize, but it, you know, what's the mood? Is it just you? Are you finding some sort of humor? You know, Mark is asking, are people getting out? You know, is there any comedy going on? Is there any attempt to allow people some escape from all that's been going on down there?
Probably informally.
Yeah.
But if it's an organizational attempt to, I don't know, like march the streets with instruments or something like that, I mean, I'm not seeing anything. I think right now, it's, you know, in times like these, it's really hard to, you know, focus on the importance of what Houston is, and losing the arts is very important. Right now, I think people are just thinking about their lives and their families and their homes. And so it's just, it's very hard to answer these questions about, you know, what's going to happen to the opera. You know, we do live in, you know, one of the performing arts capitals, you know, of the country. We have a fantastic fall season lined up. Right now, we have to think about what's going to happen to, you know, these organizations. How are they going to fare? How are they going to deal with it?
If you're hearing this and you'd like to help Houston, thousands of people are affected by Hurricane Harvey. They urgently need support. So you can help the American Red Cross provide meals and shelter to those families. And donate today to Hurricane Harvey by going to redcross.org or calling 1-800-RED-CROSS. And your sense is that help is getting in, Wei?
I think so. I mean, I've been a little bit stranded. It's right now, you know, what I know probably is what everyone else knows on social media, because, you know, in terms of other forms of communication, I've been essentially stranded on this intersection that was flooded. So my car wasn't able to get out. I've just been holed up in my apartment. Thankfully, I'm, you know,
your apartment's dry. Is your apartment all right?
It's okay. It's there was a little bit of a leak on my roof, but I'm very lucky. I'm very, very lucky.
What about your car?
Your car is stuck?
Where's your car?
I parked it across the street at a parking garage. I didn't even know if I was allowed to. I just did it because there was no parking space anywhere on the apartment complex.
Yeah.
So I just parked it about a floor up, and we were lucky. The water went up pretty high. I don't know how all the other cars that were parked on my street fared. Several of them got flooded. It's a really dangerous place to park your car anywhere on the street right now. But I've been okay, and the Houston Chronicle has been, you know, operating still at, you know, essentially maximum capacity with people going on boats and working from out of.
So, Wei, I want to ask you about what's going on at the Chronicle. We've got to take a break, so hang on, don't go away if you don't mind. Hi, everybody. This is Chris Jones. I'm here with Mark Caro on The Download. We're sitting in for Justin Kaufman tonight.
Hello.
Glad you're with us. We're talking about Houston. We have Mr. Wei Huan Chen, who is the theater critic and the classical music critic at the Houston Chronicle, with us on the line from Houston. We're glad to know that your apartment's all right, Wei. That's important. And the car's all right. And you're all right, right? At the end of the day, right, all this talk of culture, ultimately, right, Wei, it's just, are people okay, right? Are they okay? Do they feel okay?
I mean, I feel like we are in such a community mode right now. Houston is such a tight community that, like, people are asking if I'm okay. We're all trying to help each other. You know, all my friends are going out to the, you know, convention center and donating items. You know, right now there's too many clothes in some places because people are helping so much.
Yeah.
My friend, you know, has been helping a man who was homeless. I mean, one of the first few people who died to the storm were people without homes and had to take shelter in places that weren't safe. Everyone is trying to come together and volunteer, because we know, like, the police department, fire department, even the national departments don't even have enough manpower to battle all of this. So everyone is, I feel like everyone's best kind of parts of the humanity is like being brought out. Yeah.
I think it's sad that it takes a sort of reminder, but, you know, you have a disaster like this, and people are like, oh, this is what journalists do. This is what reporters do. And there's so many instances of journalists helping people, obviously also just getting the word out, which is so vitally important. And it reminds you not to put everything into a political context, but it reminds you that undermining what the job is of journalists and reporters is a dangerous thing, because you need to be able to trust sources of information when there are emergencies going on. And you also want to be reminded that people are together and they do come together in these kind of circumstances, right?
Yeah, I mean, you're seeing a lot of different kinds of families come together. Like right now, our managing editor is really thinking about us and our safety as well, and creating all sorts of resources and documents and, you know, kind of where are you, what's going on, how can you help, you know, let's all pitch in. And so the performing arts groups are doing the same as well. And even the managing editors, that they're like, some of the managing directors are going downtown and kind of risking their lives to assess the damage and try to, you know, maintain lines of communication. So we're all trying really hard to get through this, and I think we're, you know, we might be almost there. I was just talking to the HDO director, Perrin Leach, and he was like, you know, one day, you know, 6 months down the line, we're going to talk about how we survived this, because Houston has been so resilient.
This is the opera. This is the opera you're talking about.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, mm-hmm. Houston Grand Opera.
Yeah, right.
He looked at the Wortham Center and saw the damage there in one of their theaters.
So what's it like in your newsroom? Is it like, do all the critics have to be like out there, you know, doing regular reporting? Have you gone into crisis mode? Is anybody going home? Is everybody camped out in the newsroom? Take us into the...
Is the newsroom accessible to everyone?
Take us into the newsroom. What's it like there right now?
Yeah, today the roads opened up a little bit more, so a lot more people are in the newsroom. I'm looking out. There's a couple of...
You're there right now?
Maybe. Yeah, I'm there right now. There's maybe like 15, 20 people here. Mm. A lot of people have gone home. You know, there's been pizza. There's been food. We've opened up our cafeteria, you know, so anyone can take food, but we're trying to ration it out because we have a limited supply. A lot of people are just reporting from where they are. A lot of people are elsewhere and can't get in town. So we're just using a lot of other types of resources like Facebook and Google Docs and emailing each other and texting each other to stay in contact. But, yeah, it's all hands on deck. So I don't get to write my opinions on, you know, if I like this play or this play or not. I'm
right.
You know,
I can wait, right?
And, well, the plays are going to wait anyway.
Yeah, exactly. So we're all kind of focused on the same thing right now. Yeah.
So what are some of the stories that people are writing? Like, are there any sort of amazing stories that must be, right? That must be coming through the newsroom?
There's been so much storytelling coming out. I think we've written up to hundreds of these little vignettes capturing the little bits of humanity of, you know, people getting rescued off their boats. And just, you know, even if you look at the videos that are going through social media, this man catching a catfish, like, in his own home. I don't know if you guys saw that.
Right?
Just these little moments of comedy of, like, I think we're all kind of dumbstruck at the craziness of this event. And it's just everything is a little bit surreal right now.
When you're going home and you're, like, ready to go to sleep, what is that image that's sort of sticking in your head that's, you know, you wouldn't have expected to be there?
I mean, it's really just the image of outside. It used to be dry, and now there are entire lakes. I looked, you know, where the bayou is, the water covers entire parks. It's almost biblical. It's really something. So someone found a fish lying just in the middle of the street, very far away from the bayou. You go around places that should be dry, and there's sticks and stones and sand everywhere because, you know, all our streets kind of look like the bottom of a lake a little bit, and the places are really dirty. It's really something. And then the sun just came out today, and so we all kind of walked outside and kind of looked at the sun a little bit. Maybe the forecast will be a little better, but we're still crossing our fingers.
Is it raining right now?
Trying to see. It wasn't that bad earlier today. It was raining a little hard in the morning, and then it really slowed down a little bit in the afternoon. And then the sun came out, and it kind of stopped raining for a bit. So today, I think, has been the lowest water level for a couple days. Sunday was by far the worst. Sunday was really, really bad, but it's really gone down since then.
But there's still the sense that it's going to continue for a few more days, though.
Yeah, yeah. We're still in, crisis mode. The mayor just, you know, imposed a curfew, so I have to, you know, be home by 12. This is really intense.
Well, if you want to help Way and all everybody else in Houston, the way to do that, of course, is go to redcross.org or call 1-800-RED-CROSS. You know, I guess the feeling is you'll get through it, right? And you sound reasonably upbeat. I mean, you came there from Indianapolis. I can't even. You must have been like, this must be a whole shock to the system.
Yeah, absolutely. The floods. I think within like 3 months of being in Houston, my car already got flooded. So I already knew about the flooding that happens here. And that was a very minor rain, like barely any inches. And now we have, what was like more than 40 inches, of rainfall. So it's really quite something. But I really love the city really coming together and like seeing all these people volunteering. It's really heartwarming as well.
Well, Way, you know, I really thank you for, you know, you're a busy guy and the Chronicle must be going insane, and it's really kind of you to spend some time with us on the download.
Yeah, thanks so much, Way. This has been really great.
Been
and
great.
Good luck
thank
with
you so much
everything.
For tuning in.
And you know, you'll know, in a way they're special
way,
times
way.
To work for. Yeah. Well, okay. Thanks, Chris. Chris making the dumb name pun while making a serious point about how it's like these are the instances, even though they're terrible, that you really as a newsroom come together. And so I appreciate that you're having that experience, even though it's in a pretty bad context.
All the best, Way. Take care, man.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. Thank you. Bye bye. We'll be right back after these messages. Hi, everybody. This is Chris Jones right here with Mr. Mark Caro.
Hello.
We're in for Justin Kaufman on the download this evening on 720 WGN Chicago. We're glad you're joining us. We're here all the way until 11 o'clock this evening. And then we're back, Mark Caro, on Thursday for round two of the download this week.
You know, it's going to be tough to top what we have coming up tonight, though. How are we going to top it, Chris?
I don't know, but we're going to try.
We've got some more Houston stuff coming up that's going to be very interesting that you're going to tell us about. And then at 10, unprecedented, first time ever, I'm dragging my writers group into the WGN studio so I don't miss my last Tuesday of the month meeting with my writers group.
You don't want to miss that. That's very important. Well,
are they bringing us beers is what the question is. I don't know.
Are they going to make us write? That's the question.
No, we don't make anyone write. It's a writers group, so we just complain about writing. We don't actually write.
So we've been talking this last hour, we're talking about Houston, and before we do that, let me just say once again that if you would like to help the thousands affected by Hurricane Harvey that urgently need support, you can help the American Red Cross provide meals and shelter to those families. You can donate to Hurricane Harvey by going to redcross.org or calling 1-800-RED-CROSS. So coming up next, we have very good pal of mine, Mr. Jason Babinski, great actor, originally from suburban Chicago, moved to New York. You might have seen him on The Good Wife. You might have seen him on Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, House of Cards, you name it. And Mr. Babinski actually went to Houston with the thought that he was going to do a play. And then I guess Mother Nature kind of intervened. How you doing, Jason?
I'm all right. Good to hear from you, Chris.
So you went down there and you're like, okay, I'm going to do this little play, this world premiere, in fact, little kind of a prestigious gig. And then I guess things intervened. And I heard this story that you were sort of holed up at the Four Seasons, which is not a terrible place to be holed up.
You don't have to bring that up.
We've only mentioned it about 15 times. Actor trapped in the Four Seasons.
When I was waiting to come on the air, I got to hear your weather.
And then I saw pictures of you down at the Red Cross, you know, helping people out. So tell us, you know, give us your sense of what it's like there, what your take on this whole situation is.
Well, I can say today was actually not long ago before the sunset. We had our first sunlight in a week. So it was a nice little break from it all. When we got here,
Are you right now, by the way? Where are you? Where are you talking to us from?
I'm at the Four Seasons. Because it's one of those things that we're honestly, we don't even like to admit that we're at the Four Seasons.
No, I understand.
It does come with a certain amount of panache. But yeah. when we got
And now we're going to stick everyone, all the fans are going to come swarm you at the Four Seasons because we revealed that's where you are. We're sorry.
All the fans.
Right. they're getting in their boats now. They're on their way.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. Because I think all the people in Houston are like, what's going on with that actor?
They're streaming WGN and getting in their canoes.
Yeah. No, but when we got here, you know, it came with like a little, you know, and not to diminish like the threat, but people are like, yeah, there's a hurricane coming. You know, you might want to go run and get some more groceries. You know, we might be down for a couple of days. And honestly, you know, I was watching the news and I was like, all right. So I ran to the grocery store and it looked like The Walking Dead. And I was starting to understand maybe the magnitude of what I was dealing with. Cause I am a Midwestern boy that lives in New York. And so I grabbed some things and we came back. And honestly, the first day of the hurricane, me and my castmates were like, this isn't much. And we have a girl in the cast here from New Orleans.
Yeah.
And she has been through quite a few hurricanes worse than this. And it was the rain after, you know, as you know, obviously, like they've been reporting on it, that is the thing that has made it unbearable. Because what I think, the one thing that I would say, like, for anyone that hasn't been through this, and this is obviously, like, my first, is that when they say, like, the hurricane's out to sea, and they start to say, like, and when it comes back to land, it's going to get bad.
Right.
When it's out to sea, it's not unicorns and it's pouring rain.
Right.
Like they just mean that when it comes back, it's gonna get worse.
Right.
So it's not like in those moments, you know, everyone runs to the store, and that's the dilemma when you're trapped somewhere.
I think it's like the terminology of. I'm sorry to cut in. I was just gonna say I think it's like the terminology of this where they it's like a hurricane, but it was downgraded to a tropical storm, and so it's downgraded to something that's dumping more water there than has ever been dumped anywhere in the continental U.S. But it's downgraded.
Exactly. But it is that terminology too when they just say like, "Well, it's out to sea, and when it comes back, it's going to get bad." When it's out to sea, it's still pouring rain.
Yeah,
like we're talking 100% precipitation, sheets of rain, and then when it comes back, it somehow works.
So rather than sit in the Four Seasons, right, Jay, you kind of were like, okay, I guess I'm going to – did we mention you're at the Four Seasons?
Yeah. Chris, you know what? You got to quit bringing that up. But okay. We are basically kitty corner from the George Brown Convention Center.
Right.
Which is, you know, if you've been watching the news, is over capacity.
Right.
And so, you know – me and some of my castmates were like, let's go over and see what we can do.
What was it like there, man? What was it? Tell us, take us there. What was it like? What was it like there?
Well, yesterday versus today and even versus now are like three entirely different stories. Yesterday was the setup. So most people were setting up cots. Yesterday, they actually were taking dogs, which is actually uncommon for hurricanes. So there was a place called Bark, which is a shelter here in Houston. So we were setting up all the kennels and things and carriers and leashes and anything that was donated, kibble, food. And then I was setting up, I was working the MRE station, which, you know, is the meals.
Yeah.
Because we didn't have any prepared food yet. And the oddest thing is that, like, somebody dropped off a couple bags of cooked food, but you can't serve it. You know, so that stuff, you know, because it's a health risk.
They don't
know where it came from. And so it shows up at our desk. And somebody worked with the Red Cross, who's been great here on the ground, was like, we got to dump it.
Yeah.
And so then the MREs become a situation of, well, how long are we going to need these?
Yeah.
Do we wait to give them out? So it was kind of chaotic. I worked there for maybe 6 hours yesterday.
What's people's moods like? Are people good humored or is it people despairing or what's the emotions there?
I mean, the emotional state is like, I wouldn't call it good humored. I think one of the things, too, and I never really spent much time in an emergency situation like this. They tell you don't expect anyone to say thank you. And you're not getting thanks, but you just see it and you feel it. And honestly, I can say looking around and watching everyone donate their time, man, just asking somebody like, hey, can I borrow, you name it, on the streets of Chicago or New York or anyone. And in a normal situation, people, you know, you're not going to get kindness like this. It's a moment where you're like, I need help. And you look at another volunteer and you're like, hey, can you go find someone? And they just run.
Yeah.
You know, like, we need a wheelchair for this person now. And they, because I got to deal with X, Y, and Z. Can you go find that? And they go, yes. Mm-hmm. And it's that kind of stuff that is, and I saw that for 2 days straight now where it was just moments like that where.
Feeds your soul, right?
Really, It does. And the people, like, you know, the people are, it's early too. This is the thing I'll say. They were very gracious. They were very happy to have somewhere to go. We were setting up showers today. That was my job today. We got the showers up and running over there at the convention center. So they had hot water. They had shampoo. They had conditioner. They had the whole deal. And people are just grateful. But, you know, as the days goes on, that's the situation now, where it's like, what's going to happen down the line?
Well, if you want to help out, let me just throw this in, Jay. If you want to help out, you can just go to redcross.org or call 1-800-RED-CROSS. Now, your show is not happening, right? You've gone down there to do a play, a pretty important new play. Are you just like, well, that was a nice assignment. Well, that's not going to happen. Or what's going on with that?
Well, I mean, that's the other craziness about the arts. You know, there is some, Chris, I mean, I'm not kidding, dude. It's like the show must go on somehow. I do a shift this morning. And actually, here's what I'll say about helping out with the Red Cross, too. There are so many volunteers that online now, you set up for a time slot. They don't even want people showing up anymore. And that's what I mean about that humanity. Like, people are just showing up. And, like, so tomorrow we're going to possibly find a time slot to go over there. But it used to be you just showed up and they sent you on a job. But I'll say, because some of my castmates got turned away, I couldn't sleep last night. I got over there kind of early. But as I'm over there, I'm getting texts. And Rajiv Joseph, who is our playwright of this wonderful new play, is like, I got a rewrite of scene that I want to read.
So work is getting done.
Honestly, though, and this is what's crazy and inspiring, and I'll go back to crazy. They're trying to find – our theater, by the way, is flooded, flooded. The Alley Theater has taken on a lot of water. The lobby area down at the New House Theater, which is where our theater is fully underwater to the ceiling. Apparently, they're looking for other options. So there is still right now – you know, there's a show must go on mentality. And, you know, but we have only 3 actors from New York, and we have 4 that are resident company members here at the Alley. And they are scattered around the city. One is up in Waco, Texas. She fled the city.
Yeah.
She's got a newborn child. And so there is still some hope or some type of ambition to actually mount some type of show. It might not
be
realized, you know. You know, and I don't know what's going to happen. We just seriously, tomorrow's another day. We know the city is actually kind of opening up a little bit. Like there are a couple of restaurants that just kind of popped up and opened.
Yeah. Hey, Jay. Hey, hang on a sec. We're going to take a quick break. I don't want you to go away, though. I've got a couple of things we want to talk to you about. This is Chris Jones, Mark Carroll here on The Down Low. We're talking with Jason Babinski live from Houston. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this. Hey, everybody, this is Chris Jones in with Mark Caro on Chicago's very own 720 WGN. We're in for Justin Kaufman on The Download.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining us. So we're still on the line with the great actor Jason Babinski, stage and TV actor, appeared in Good Wife, Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, House of Cards, many, many fine theatrical events, including Billy Elliot right here in Chicago. But he ain't dancing right now. He's in Houston, where it's a little soggy. Yeah. So are you using this experience? Yeah. Like, so what are you? Is this going to make you a deeper actor now? This experience of being done.
Oh wow. I don't know.
That's a lot of pressure, Chris. Let the guy just help.
Thank you, Mark. It's horrible. Like, what do I do with a question like that? No, I have to say. I will say it, though. I loved being – it's remarkable. I don't know if you guys have ever volunteered your time anywhere. And if you
Not
if
enough,
you
frankly, no.
You should. But, like, you get into these situations, and you go from being a pawn to a king in about 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Because nobody – you know, it's all volunteers, right? Even the people that are wearing the head badges. And you walk in, and they go, we need you to go do this. And you don't even know what that is. And you run over there. And next thing you know, like with MREs, I've never put together MREs are the military fashion meals, right?
Right.
I've never done one of those. Well, the people getting them go, how do you cook them?
Right.
And I go, and everyone looks around. I go, let me see the instructions. I make them. Next thing you know, I'm the guy that instructs people on how to cook them.
Yeah.
You know, it's those strange things where it's just like, people start taking initiative and people start helping. It really is. It's remarkable, even in chaos, what we can do together. And I know that sounds a little kumbaya, like let's all hug. But like, it really is like really nice to sit with people and be like, can you help me with this? And somebody, they don't judge it. They just go, yes. You know, and, you know, I don't know. Like, is that going to make me a deeper actor? And I hope so.
Why not?
I would think that, you know, as an actor, your job is to understand people and to be able to portray them. And so when you're in a situation like this where you're seeing so many different kinds of behavior of people who are under pressure, which frankly, the whole point of acting is you're usually acting as people who are under some pressure because that's what makes it dramatic.
Right.
I would think on some level it would help you just in terms of going through a memorable experience of filled with emotions.
Yeah, it is. And I would say this too. It's been like kind of a tug and pull of different things. Like we were kind of feeling good. We saw the sun come out.
Yeah.
And then we got the warning that tonight is we have a curfew.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw this. You know,
we did see that.
To five. Yeah. So it just comes with there is this also dark underbelly of what's going on out there.
Right. Are you seeing any of that? You're not seeing any of that.
I'm not really seeing any of that. I can't not say that I haven't seen some selfishness even within the confines of, but it's for me, I look at it, I'm like, well, that's just human behavior. Like somebody wants more.
Right.
Like they come up to the table and they're like, can I get three? And it's like, no.
Right.
And they get a little mad. I've been sworn at as well the last couple of days. But you just brush that off. You're like, I understand why you're mad because you don't know how long you're going to be here. You're not sure. You know, it's fear-based. It's all that kind of stuff where you're like, but, you know, and if you can give more, you do. And that was another wonderful thing. It's like we had a lot of towels donated, a lot of things. And people, you know, we didn't have enough cots at the convention center. People are sleeping on floors. And it's people just find ways. Like, can you get me another blanket? Some boom, run. Get some another blanket. You know, it's that kind of stuff. And honestly, it like, because right now with how politicized the world is and how disjointed we all are, it's nice to see people working together, you know?
Yeah.
Have you spent much time in Houston before this period?
You know, I had forgotten. I had done a production of Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, the Theater Under the Stars, right here in Houston. And it was a while ago. And that came back to me, and I think I came through here once on tour, but not enough. But, I honestly came down, and I was, I'm at the Four Seasons, and I will tell you, the first night I was here, they have a nice poolside bar with a jacuzzi. I'm in my swim trunks, thinking
like,
summer's going to go
on. This is sweet.
This is actor dream time. And next thing you know, I'm somebody's asking me, like, can you go clean the bathroom at the convention center?
I mean, is the Four Seasons like still the Four Seasons?
You brought it up, by the way, Jason. Let me just note that we did not hit you with the Four Seasons thing in this segment.
Is it still the Four Seasons as we know it, or is it like been co-opted by the situation?
No, it has not been co-opted. It has limited staff and whatnot.
It's
still, like I had a beer at the Four Seasons here tonight. You know, like when I got home.
Right.
But we're hoping by tomorrow some things are going to start opening. It's just, the dilemma now is like, what kind of traffic with the amount of roads being shut can actually get to any work or get, like, these are those strange things where like, well, surely everything's going to start to reopen, but it's like, how do you get down here when the roads are flooded? And we did quite a few adventures around just to see what the bayous look like. And I have no frame of how high that water truly got. But I know it's higher, and when the streets have basically white water on it,
It must be wild. It must be wild to talk to your family in Chicago and your wife in New York and all that. And everyone here is like, we have no clue of what that's like. It's just, we look out on, I'm looking out on dry old Michigan Avenue right here. It's like an ordinary day. I'm like,
it's a little drizzly.
It's
a little gray.
It's like, it must be surreal to be in the middle of all that, man.
Yeah, no, it is. I will say my wife has been with me 100%. My dad has done what I would expect you know, my 72-year-old father to do. Be like, but you got a car down there. You could just go get something. And it, and then it comes with that, like, and it's like, Dad, there's no one working. Like, there's nowhere. Like, even if I could get somewhere.
Which you can, right?
No one, yeah, you can't, you know. And that's the thing that is frightening. And being in the downtown area is, you know, we didn't get hit as bad as other areas.
Yeah.
We do have some cast members farther outside. One of our castmates has been texting us. He's without power right now. And he's saving his battery. He's not sure if they're going to have to evacuate that area because the water still rises, even if the rain dies down, and the rain has died down, but you know.
Well, Jason, we wish you, you know, we wish you the very best, and we want to just remind everybody, if you want to donate, you can go to redcross.org, 1-800-RED-CROSS. You can't maybe easily get, like Jason, get right to the shelter, but you can call that number and send some cash their way, buy some meals, help some folks out, good people down there in Houston. And we hope you get to do your... We hope you get to do your show.
Yeah. I want you to do it in a barn. You can do it in a Houston barn.
Let them know, man. We'll do it.
If you build it, we will come. Chris and I will get in the canoe. I'll stern. He'll bow. We'll be down there in a few hours.
Jason, stay dry, my friend. All the best to you. We'll see you when you get back.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. That was Jason Babinski talking to us from Houston, where he's been helping out with the volunteer effort in the hope of actually doing the show that he, you know, was originally scheduled to go down there and do, which didn't quite work out. And when I write the book about my love, it will be about a man who was told. Hey, everybody, this is Chris Jones. I'm here with Mark Caro.
Hello.
Here in for Justin Kaufman. You are listening to The Download on Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago. All is well in the city of Chicago, 9 minutes past 10 on a Tuesday night. Cubs have won. What more could we ask?
I know what we could ask. Really awesome guests.
All right. So here's what we're going to do. So Mark, this is an interesting thing. So Mark generally has this Tuesday night writers group. He has brought live for the first time, if I'm correct in saying, ever on the air, Mark and his writers group. Writers group, all live in the studio, which is just filled up with writers.
Those are not mannequins across
the street. They're actual. We have real writers.
If you're on Michigan Avenue and you're looking in the window like these nice people are doing, hey, you would see real writers. There are five real writers just in here.
So, Mark Caro, tell us who has joined us in the Showcase studio.
In the Showcase studio, going left to right, we have James Finn Garner, the author of Politically Correct Bedtime Stories, which was huge.
Big seller.
And his newest book is called The Wet Nose of Danger, which is a Rex Coco private clown mystery. They're very funny, too. You know, the clown noir genre has not gotten its adequate due, but James Finn Garner is doing that. To his left is Mr. Pat Burns, who is a renowned New Yorker cartoonist. He did the Daily New Yorker cartoon this spring 10 weeks in a row. That was a lot of work. He's also the author of Captain Dad, The Manly Art of Stay-at-Home Parenting. And he is very manly, Pat Burns is.
Looks manly for a
while. And then all the way over, far to the left if you're facing me, or far to the right if I'm facing you, Paul Erickson, master parodist. He is the author of The New, The Lost Star Wars Diary Imagined Production Notes. And Paul and Jim were just at Comic-Con, Wizard World, over the weekend, dressing in costumes and selling their books. And I'll just say as background, too, that so our writers group meets at a Northside bar of sort of rotates around last Tuesday of the month. This is the last Tuesday of the month. And Chris Jones is always invited. He often has some theater thing to go to. And I say, well, come by afterwards. And he hasn't come to it. So we brought
agenda.
The writers group.
It's on my agenda.
So we brought the writers group
to
Chris, because I think Chris will get along with him. So, Chris, you know, you could ask them questions and you guys could get to know each other. And we could also talk about, well, how's writers group tonight? Because I missed most of it because I was in here.
They had a lot of really good stuff on tap.
Yeah, move up on the mic, Pat Burns. That was Pat Burns with the not quite man. I did this whole manly introduction of you, and then you're like, not get manly on the mic. So you guys had the beers at Howls and Hood, where there are 114 different beers.
Or, oh yeah, yeah, all lined up.
Couldn't get.
You're gonna have to find. You know, that's closing. That's closing. Howls and Hood.
They got another year though. I think
until May. They're closing when the Tribune Tower moves to its becomes new owners. So they're out of here. In a few months.
The taps go with them.
So what is a writer's group like? What do you do? Do you ever write in the group, or do you buoy each other up?
Buoying is a lot of it.
You look like a buoying type to me.
We're pretty buoyant people.
We will do it. We meet every month. We examine where we're at, where we want to be, what we've done, what we haven't done through the month. But once a year, we do take off to Michigan and we do a writer's retreat, and then we actually do write in front of each other. And it's like...
What does that mean? So, what do you mean? You have your laptops?
I'm not really in front of you when I'm writing. I usually find another quiet
around.
Corner.
Well, left or right or...
So the sham is revealed. You know, who's really writing and who's not? Because you could show up every month and not have written anything and talk a good game. But when we go off for our retreat,
once a year,
really writing.
If we can get coordinate schedules.
Who is of all the people before me in this room, including Mark Carrow? So who is the who really gets it done? Like, which of you like has no problem cranking it out? Anybody?
Oh, cranking it out. That would be me. No,
that's Paul Erickson.
My work is a parody, so it's kind of formulaic. It's sort of right by numbers. So every year, my publisher in Germany, Pieper Verlag. Will ask me, they'll say, how about this year a Star Wars parody? And then I'll say, oh, thank heaven you asked me for Star Wars as opposed to Divergent or Harry Potter, because I can do that. And yeah, and then I go forth and write a book during my lunch break over the course of a year. And
you just sit down and the words just flow out of your fingers.
It's easy if you have a starting point. I don't have to worry about story arcs like these guys do, or characters or quality.
He's putting characters and quality in quotes, just so you know. You can't see the air quotes at home, people.
And who has the worst writer's block?
He's not here.
Yeah, I was going to say, the ones who show up.
Him. Still home with that mental.
The most productive ones aren't here, probably. Two of the most productive ones.
Yeah, Jonathan Eig is in our group, and he doesn't show up that much because he's been too busy finishing this opus about Muhammad Ali that's coming out in October. That's going to be awesome. And John Eig has written a lot of excellent books. Luckiest Man about Lou Gehrig and... Get Capone was one. The Birth of the Pill was his most recent one.
Yeah, I read the Capone one and the Pill one.
Yeah, and this one. But this one is going to be really something. I mean, they're all really something. But this is sort of his opus. And I think that also the timing of it. I mean, Ali was alive when he was working on it for most of the time. Mm. And they're really – John has this great knack of discovering sort of what books should have been written by now but haven't been. And the idea that there isn't, in his mind, a definitive Muhammad Ali biography, and he's found all the stuff that hasn't been... I'm promoting his book. He's not even here. I'm going to stop in a second.
But he's in the group.
But he's in the group. So maybe he'll be on the show, when we do this in October. But anyway, it's so he's been productive. I admire his productivity, but he's too productive to show up for our group, apparently.
Well, we give people slack then. It's like, are you writing a book for publication? Oh, that's cool. You don't have to come on this month.
What is the group ever done? Has the group ever given you an idea that you didn't previously have? Has Mark, have you ever been writing something and then one of these guys has said, you should do this instead? And have you ever followed it?
Well, one of the things, we used to do this more often, but when we're working on stuff, we will send it around and I'll get good feedback on it. And I'll say, hey, I got this little funny idea or something like that. Jim is very good also at writing, sort of shorter pieces and sending them around because he goes to, he'll go to programs where people are doing staged readings and this and that, and or little radio plays. And so we do give each other feedback. And even Pat, when he was working on his cartoons, sometimes
we
were
the daily.
When you do the dailies,
Jim and I used to write comedy together. In fact, it was an old comedy act that we did that spawned Rex. But back when I was doing the daily for the New Yorker, one night I had an idea that I wanted to do and I'd been wanting to do for a long time, and it just needed to hammer out the caption.
Yeah,
I write stuff and it's like 12 words is long.
Yeah,
but. I needed to hammer out a caption, so we stuck around for an extra round, and hammered out a caption.
What was the you're going to tell us what it was? What
it was it was Donald Trump sitting at his desk and Boris and Natasha from Rocky and Bullwinkle popped up behind him
and he was tweeting.
Trump was tweeting and Boris was saying, hang on, let me
tell,
get it.
Tell them it's fake news.
Tell them is fake news. Work of Moose and Squirrel. And we couldn't find a way to write the laugh of Boris, but
that would be wahaha.
No, he was. That's the classic wahaha. But he did it slightly differently. It was
nice.
Yeah.
So without that group, the cartoon would not have been.
It might not have existed.
It wouldn't have been quite the same.
And Chris, just so you know, Mark wrote the subtitle for my book at the writer's retreat.
What was the what
is imagined production notes? I think the word imagined was what I, because you were trying to figure out how do you get this parody of George Lucas's diary out without it looking like it's actually George Lucas's diary.
AKA not getting sued,
right?
So these are imagined production notes as if written by George Lucas.
Correct. And so while I'm pitching this at Comic-Con, I will tell people once or twice during the pitch, I'm lying to you. Right now, because every once in a while it's like, really, George Lucas? He left his 8x10 legal pad with you? That's crazy. And I'll say, yeah, I'm making this up. Really, this is just
their eyes get really.
So did the German publisher say to you, do an imagined George Lucas diary? Or did they say, let's do a Star Wars thing, and that's what you came up with?
They wanted something like the YouTube film flubs sort of thing where they point out stuff that's wrong with the movie. I can't, there's a word for it.
Continuity errors?
Right.
Yeah, or
gaffes.
Yeah, and so they were thinking something like that, and I said, well, all right, this is a book rather than a video, so that'll be a challenge. So I thought, okay, production notes books, those are kind of cool, and I don't want to go to the trouble of illustrating it, but so I wrote fake production notes. So it's George Lucas's journal from 1973. He's just finishing American Graffiti and now coming up with ideas for his second science fiction film, a sequel to THX 1138, originally titled THX 1139.
Much more commercial idea.
Well, he thought maybe get rid of the chrome robots and everyone having their heads shaved and maybe make it a little more upbeat. And that might do better at the box office.
All right. Well, on that note, we had a real live writers group going on here on The Download with Chris Jones, Mark Caro, fabulous guests. We'll be right back after these messages. Welcome to The Download, the final hour with Mark Caro and me, Chris Jones, here till 11 o'clock.
Hey.
Keeping you company.
Hello.
On this Tuesday night, we're doing a cool thing here. We've got Mark's Writers Group live in the studio.
You know, the Writers Group has a name, Chris. Do you know what the name of it is?
I did not know that. What is it?
Why don't you ask the person who came up with the name. That would be James Finn Garner.
What's the name?
Author of The Wet Nose of Danger, a Rex Coco private clown mystery.
Years ago, it was all in favor of meeting tonight. Shout Hunger Dunger. So we have become the Hunger Dungers. And you know the origin of that, right?
No.
Oh.
Come on, Chris.
Wow, look at that scoff.
The Marx Brothers?
Oh, right.
Their legal team?
It's Hunger Animal Crackers.
Hunger Dunger, Hunger Dunger, Hunger Dunger.
Yeah, I got it.
And McCormick.
These references and go
Hunger
right by me.
And Hunger Dunger.
Right over my head.
When you're doing the Marx Brothers references, you know it's a hip young group.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Exactly. Okay, so if I'm listening out there and I'm like, well, here are these guys yakking on in their writers group. Maybe I'm thinking I'm a writer. You know, how do I get published? How do I get in a – how do I do this? So what fine advice do you have for the WGN listeners? And by the way, if you want to ask your own question of these guys, you can call us 312-981-7200 or you can text us at the same number. So how do I do that?
Right. You're looking at me. I one of the interesting things about this group is that there are people who have people have published things in different ways. So Paul has his German publisher who says come up with our Star Wars. But before that, what was your book before that? Was it The Wobbit?
I wrote Washington Mutual Bank had gone out of business in 2008. I was suddenly out of work for 2 years. And during that time, to stop feeling sorry for myself, I wrote a parody of my favorite book, Tolkien's The Hobbit. Mm. And I ran into Jim, who I knew from back in the day, and he said, oh, you've actually finished a book. Well, you know, let me help you put it on Kindle. And I put it on Kindle, and then like a few months later, I get an email from Munich saying, have you, I swear to God.
That's what happens. Actually
happened. And I first thought, okay, which of these knuckleheads sent me this thing? I get this email from Munich saying, have
because,
you sold?
Hello, we read your Hobbit parody. We are very amused.
Your Hobbit.
Have you sold
we think
the...
it's very funny in Germany, Deutschland, ja.
Yeah. So they, have you sold the international rights? And I said, no. And I asked Jim, is this a good deal? And he said, is it better than the other deals you're getting for your book? And that really tipped it in. And I've, you know, they've asked me to do three books since. It's crazy lucky, but it's crazy lucky because I use the tool that anyone can use. You take a Word file, you put it in Kindle, and let the marketplace decide.
And these are in English, right? So there's a great capacity in Germany for English language parodies.
Actually, they, heaven help them, they translate everything that I write.
Oh, right.
So all of the idiomatic language jokes that I've written, they rewrite.
And then Paul has to translate it back into English just to put it up here. So that's why it reads so funky.
Yeah, I always thought if I translate their German version of my jokes back in English, it will actually be the original Tolkien stuff.
They actually use Google Translate on it, which really makes it good.
Yeah.
But so this is an example where you did not get an agent. Because everyone, people are always asking, well, should I get an agent? Do I need an agent? And in this case, you did not get an agent. You did not try to shop this in New York. You just said, I've written this. I want to get this out there. And you did that.
Yeah, I gave up after 30 tries of agent queries. And that was enough. And
yeah, never quit, Paul. At least when you get 30, then quit.
Well, and Jim, you've been on, you know, both sides of this too. I mean, you had you know, politically correct bedtime stories. You've had
that
a bunch of other movies
before it became a number one bestseller.
Yeah, exactly.
How many rejections did that have?
30, all types. It's too long. It's too short. It's not hip. It's not. It's too hot. It's too cold. And then it came out, and it was a hit from customer demand. And everybody kept saying, yeah, we knew it would be a hit all along. No big deal.
You got a letter from a president on that one, as I recall.
Letter from President Clinton saying, we thought it was hilarious. We're giving it to friends for Christmas. So, yeah, it was cool. So that was back then. You know, it's an up and down thing. John Green, the author, once described it as a sine wave as far as your sales and your interest. And it's you got to be ready to ride the troughs and the peaks. So since then, I've self-published books. I've had a book that Amazon published on as a Kindle exclusive, and you just have to keep putting stuff out and being open to ideas and also being open to marketing your stuff, because that's one thing our group is really good at. Like, what I've got an idea, what do I do with it, or how do I capitalize on the what I'm working on right now? Like John Ige, working on that Muhammad Ali book, came to our meeting and said, I'm getting all these great stories from Angelo Dundee and Muhammad Ali's second wife and third wife. These I can't put them in the book, but they're fascinating, crazy stories. And we said, put them out as a podcast. And so he's done that for like 15 episodes of real interviews with real people who knew Muhammad Ali. And they're incredibly whacked out, colorful people. And
so it's a great way to build up to the book, too.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Deal with rejection?
Drinking with a writer's group.
do you commiserate with each other when somebody gets turned down?
Most of what we do is commiserate, I would say.
Well, it's like getting bad contracts or getting not enough attention for a project, or a project dies on the vine or whatever, and we commiserate about that. One reason I got the book club, book writers group together in the first place was that isolation that writers feel, and that's why I'm glad I did, because it's just, you know, it's just once a month getting together, but we all know the situation. We all know the frustration and the isolation mainly that writers simply have to deal with.
All right.
And sometimes it's just being able to, for me anyway, it's an opportunity to have conversations with adults that don't begin with, may I take your order?
Well, on that note, we've got Mark's live writers group right here in the Showcase Studio on 720 WGN. Don't go away. We've got more Bon Nuggets, Bon Mo's about the writing profession. We'll be right back. Hello, everybody. This is Chris Jones. I'm here with Mark Caro.
Hello.
You're in the last 20-some minutes of The Download. We're here till 11 o'clock. We're back on Thursday, if you're thinking there's not enough of these guys left.
We're going to make you really miss Justin Kaufman. Thank you, Justin, for letting us
Yeah, what a great honor. So we've been here since 7. We're excited. We've had a good time. We're back on Thursday, as I said. In our final segment, we have Mark's Writers Group live in the Showcase studio. So, Mark, tell us who's with us and what's going on.
All right, we got James Finn Garner.
Hello.
We have Pat Burns.
Hello.
And we have Paul Erickson.
Hi.
So, oh, Paul, writers. Just all writers, and we meet the last Tuesday of the month, and so we brought the party here. Chris, do you remember the name of the group?
No.
It makes it seem so sophisticated.
Say it again.
The Hunger Dungers.
It's a nerdy Marx Brothers thing. Jim Garner Marx came Brothers up with it. So Jim Garner and Paul Erickson were just at Comic-Con over the weekend, formerly known as Wizard World, still called Wizard World.
Yeah. What is that thing? I don't know much about that.
It's a pop culture four-day-long convention. It's not just comics. It is TV, video gaming. Lou Ferrigno was there. Lonnie Anderson was there. A lot of wrestlers this weekend.
How is Lonnie Anderson
in the same room?
Well, those two ideas are always in my in my head. Yeah.
We're told wrestling and Lonnie Anderson doing very well.
Yes, Lonnie's doing fine. Who else was there this weekend?
What does Lonnie Anderson look like? I don't mean to be
Kato
tacky.
Kato Kaelin was there.
Kato Kaelin.
Ruling the roost this weekend.
Really? Billy
Boyd was there.
Kato Kaelin, the most famous Brewers fan.
So what does a writer do at this thing?
Well, we shill books. We're out there haranguing people that they should read books with less pictures in the book.
So Jim, James Finn Garner, has
I'm the only guy with three names.
There you go. Because people, you don't want people to confuse you with, you know, Victoria Rockford Files, Jim Garner. So Jim, you're out there with your Rex Coco book, The Wet Nose of Danger, which is his clown noir. Paul, you're there with your, Star Wars imagined memoir, The Lost Star Wars Diary. So are you guys like in costume? Is that fun?
Well, when you say it, that's great.
Were you dressed up as a, Ewok?
Totally awesome. Now, I write parodies of Tolkien. I've written The Wobbit, a parody, and I've written Super Friends of the Ring, my parody of The Fellowship of the Ring, as well as Jar Jar Wars and The Lost Star Wars Diary. So I have the challenge of dressing for both of these. So I dress as Qui-Gon Baggins, the Jedi Hobbit.
Really?
That's the big payoff.
So you were actually promoting all of these books, so you tried to dress as some sort of hybrid Hobbit Star Wars character.
Again, when you say it doesn't sound as fun.
I wish I'd seen it. No, it's
yeah, and
because people think writers' lives are dignified, and it's just good for us to dispel this. So, okay.
The Germans like me, and I looked this up. They like American authors because we don't work hard to sound smart, apparently, like the German authors do.
There you go.
At least that's not true in my case. And then Jim,
there are fewer German hobbits too.
True.
Okay.
Jim cosplays. That's the trade term.
I know cosplay in my household.
Yes,
as Rex Coco, private clown. And last year in the fall, I do the Wizard World in this time of year last year, and then in September I get pictures on my Facebook of a guy dressed like me.
So someone cosplays you.
Somebody cosplayed my character. Other than me. So first it takes about an hour to get used to that idea. And then I reach out to the guy. And he's a guy named Matthew out in Batavia. And he came in and we introduced ourselves this month. And it's hilarious that he likes the book so much he's going to dress like me. So we didn't do any Lucille Ball, things as a pair of twins behind a mirror or something like that, which would have been really
cool. There's a Marx Brothers routine you could refer to for that too.
I know. That's too nerdy.
Do you ever get existential angst that like, I'm a smart guy, and this is what I've come down to.
what would make you...
That's okay, guys. I'm not offended at all.
Not in the least.
No, I
am actually very proud that I write the world's only clown noir mystery novels. And it's like, this is what I'm here on Earth
to do. What is clown noir exactly?
Clown noir is taking the old noir ideas from mystery novels, Maltese Falcon and Murder, My Sweet, and those kind of things. And I take those stories and I populate them with washed-up circus characters from Sarasota. So there's a fat lady runs the burlesque house in town. It's the seedy underbelly of the circus, and it fits really well with old criminal underworld stories. So, the murders are a little bit bigger. The people are a little more showy. They're just bigger personalities. And it, to me, it works great.
And it has its own kind of lingo.
Yeah, both, you know, I have hard-boiled lingo and circus lingo. So now you say things like abba-dabba and alley-oop and clown-a-lee and things like that. So it's a whole other world. It's circus people were – don't get me on this, Chris. Don't get me started on this. Circus people were disreputable people in the main back in the yes. 20s, 30s, and 40s.
Yeah, I'm a circus geek, so you're on my territory.
I realize that.
Right.
And everyone else can just tune out. Chris and I are going to be on the radio. But that's an underbelly, like almost like an ethnic group. So it was like they're excluded, but they're stuck there too. So that was the tension that I like to play with the stories. So, you know, in the third book, I have them in Europe fighting Nazis because it makes for a better story, you know.
So I guess the takeaway, if you get a really good idea, you can make a series out of it, right? I mean, you can create a whole, right? I mean, it's one idea that you've been able to string into more than one.
It's kind of evergreen. Yeah, I wouldn't stretch it if it didn't work right. You know, it's like I love Terry Pratchett. I loved Douglas Adams. I love those series of books. And as soon as I found one, Pat and I worked on this character 25 years ago on stage. And when I adapted it to a book and it worked, I'm like, oh, this is great. I'm loving this. I'm loving doing this.
So is the guy cosplaying you or is he cosplaying Rex Coco?
That's a good question. I think he's Rex Coco. I think he's out in the world doing Rexy things. He's doing my bidding out there as a Rex cosplayer.
He dialed up the Rex a little higher because he had the nose.
Yeah, he had
the clown shoes.
And the clown shoes, which I don't really do.
It was pretty awesome.
Frankly, people are frightened of clowns. So I keep the makeup down to a minimum so I can talk to people and they don't
They want to buy your book.
They want to buy your book from the scary clown.
They're not just throwing money at me to get me to stay away. You know, I've got to actually talk to them and sell the book.
But, was this effective? Did you guys have a good weekend?
It was wonderful.
Yeah. What's a good docket? Like how many? What's a good? If you sell 50 books, is that good? Is it 500 books?
It depends. Paul sells more than I do. I'm out there, you know, trying to build the brand.
Right.
Because I'm pandering to the hardcore nerds, of course.
And you've got that German publisher behind you.
Yeah. So I mean,
he's got the Star Wars brand.
Right. Like. So you sell a lot, like hundreds?
I wish. 50 books for me is pretty good. Over 40.
That's a lot of books.
And if I was at like a library event, I would never get close to that.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
So it's huge fun,
and the people are great, and
everyone gets a membership in the Nerd Paradise Club.
I'm getting the card here. Yeah. Oh, Nerd Paradise Club.
Yeah. So we have membership cards. We have all sorts of giveaways. Jim is giving out posters. It's
and circus peanuts, which is often a hard sell too. But
people love
How do you? How do you?
So Pat doesn't make. I'm sorry.
How do you serialize cartoons? Like, can you do that as a cartoonist?
These days, it's very, very difficult. And it's
Why?
Because everyone wants content for free.
What?
They do.
That's a shocking thing to say.
Shocking, but true.
Oh, my goodness.
But without getting into too much, there is the possibility that we are on a cusp of finding a way to make cartoons actually a profitable enterprise again.
How are you going to do that?
The internet, surprisingly, is a great vehicle for that because it turns out there was a study done at a particular Ivy League university on what's the most engaging internet content. Mm. And other than the breakout viral video, it's cartoons.
Really?
Yeah, and particularly the New Yorker style cartoons, and New Yorker in particular.
Yeah.
And that's got to be worth some dough, I'm telling you. Because it's cartooning is the gag cartooning, the New Yorker style, is such a condensed form of storytelling. It's embodies all the skills that are so prized right now, the extreme messaging and all that. Yeah. But it's, you know, you get a whole story there in like 4 seconds. Boom! You got to get a, you know, people can see a backstory. They see where it's going, all because of that one moment that you've crystallized, and that's just ideal material for the internet.
What do you think of the captioning contest? Sort of
that's a good question.
That seems to have gotten. Does that irritate you? Because I get irritated by like citizen reviewers. I hate that. I don't want to know you. Experts only. Thank you. What do you think about?
Once I occasionally get out to New York and for the Tuesday morning drop offs, And afterwards, the more important part is the cartoonist lunch. And I was at one of those actually a few years ago when the caption contest wasn't so old. And one of the gods of cartooning, Gayon Wilson, was had his turn to speak on that. And he thought, what I think would be great is if you had like a 4,000-word David Remnick column where people got to write the last paragraph. And that's hearing great.
David Remnick being the editor of the New Yorker,
yeah, who writes these wonderful, wonderfully
right.
deep, right.
dense
right,
pieces. Right. And Gayon Wilson, of course, his work is incredibly dense and dark and brilliant. And that resonated because so much work goes into creating that image, and that image was actually part of an idea that image exists only to serve. Mm. And so you've taken part of that idea away and have people try and replace it.
Do you think these are mostly ideas that didn't quite work? And so you're like, all right, I got this kind of funny drawing, but the caption didn't work. So here, you can have that.
Yes, that's true. Sometimes they are efforts to arrive at an idea and it never quite gets there. But very often they are cartoons that were complete and they just thought, wow, that image is so vibrant. Matt Diffie has had several of his used as a caption contest images, and several of them, and one of them, someone came up with the exact same caption he had. And it was voted second.
So this is an instance.
But a couple others where people actually nailed his exact caption. So that was the thing that won because it made sense with the image.
So is this something where you turned it in and they say, you know what, instead of running this in the magazine the way it is, we're just going to take the caption off and put it in the contest. Sorry. Or often congratulations.
Often it happens that way. And sometimes people do submit ones that are, they've just got a wacky image and they don't know how to finish it. And they think, hey, that might be a good caption contest image. And so they submit that.
Have you been in the caption contest?
They've only bought one of mine for it. And I don't think they ever used it.
It'll happen.
So if we were in your writer's group now, this was, let's forget the running, let's forget those microphones and all the rest of it. Like, what would you be doing now?
Suddenly got the check about this hour.
Yeah, because I'd be in the bathroom when the check came.
But you'd just be like having a drink, or you go intern. What do you do?
Yeah, I think usually you sort of make sure that, you know, trying to figure out what everyone's working on, and usually people are working on multiple things, so I'd be, you know, saying, I would have been asking about Comic-Con just like we just were, and I would have been asking Pat, well, what's going on with what you're working on, and you sort of go around. And
sometimes you just grumble and go, and it moves on to somebody else, and it's a conversation of people among people who share a livelihood and way of life and
value the hard work that, you know, this does take.
If any of you out there in Radioland are in a writer's group or artistic group or something, and you want to join this conversation, 312-981-7200. Feel free to give us a call as we had the last 9 minutes of our show here. But I mean, there are groups, right? I mean, people sort of meet for support, whether they're writers or, you know, I mean, I'm in a book group that's been meeting for more than 20 years. So people have their different groups, and this has just sort of become like a group of friends where it's good when we send each other stuff to read and get feedback on it, but it's also good to just sort of get together and say, all right, I'm frustrated by this, I'm trying to sell this, I'm not finishing that, and just kind of have that sort of push to try to get things going a little bit more, and maybe another idea on how to approach something.
Well, it's a lonely business, right? I mean, it's a way to, right? Fundamentally, what we were talking about is companionship, isn't it? I mean, like, I'm always struck with you, Mark, how this group matters to you. You're always like, it's my writer's group.
Well, it's the last Tuesday of the month.
It's the last Tuesday of the month.
It's a free pass. Right. Well, I think also, I think Pat was sort of alluding to this also. It's you know, it's like the family and, you know, wife who goes to bed very early because she's got a morning radio job. And, you know, so this is just sort of like, no, this is important. And it's also, and it's not just that sort of free pass thing. It's sort of committing yourself to thinking seriously about writing and what you're doing, and that you're among people who feel take it seriously enough to have a beer and joke about it for a couple hours.
Yeah, I mean, we don't get a paycheck for it anymore. Nobody in the writers group but one has a paying job for writing.
Yeah, I used to be the only one.
Right.
And we've had, and the jobs keep coming and going, but it's really hard just to stay motivated in the middle of winter when you could just be watching television.
All right, so before we wrap this up, I'd love to hear what is everybody presently working on? Let's go around the room. Why don't you start?
That's Paul Erickson.
Paul, yeah, come on.
Thank you. Clearing away the wreckage from Comic-Con and trying to keep my website up to date.
Okay.
What's your website?
Nerdparadist.com.
Well, what's the next book? You've got a book. What's the next
writing?
What
do the Germans want next?
I think they want many printings of the book that they're going to be publishing in November.
Which is?
The
Star Wars.
The Lost Star Wars Diary, or whatever the German translation is.
We are very happy. We are very looking forward to this.
They got a new Star Wars movie all the time now, so there's a constant promotion. So that's a good franchise to book to.
Always working on my weekly batch. I have 10 cartoons a week that I have to generate and turn out. Most weeks, at about 40 weeks a year, if you just like break down about 400 cartoons a year, to submit, to get rejected, and get sent off to the next place to get rejected. And hope that, you know, end of the year, maybe you sell 1 out of 5, which, you know, that adds up. And then there's another project working on trying to, among some of the New Yorker cartoonists, to help share with people in business some of the creativity skills that we develop.
That's a cool idea.
I'm working on the plot for my next book for Rex Coco. It'll be called Notoriousness. And I just had a one-act play produced out at the Theater of Western Springs, which is really satisfying, back in August. So,
what was that called?
That was called Locavores, about a cannibalistic restaurant.
Mark Caro, what about you? Final thing.
Me? Oh, wow.
So many
projects. Let's see. I got this nonfiction thing that I think I'm still working on. And I've got a Chicago Magazine story due in a week that I'm not going to talk about because it hasn't been published yet. And September 11th, you know what? The book that I had published most recently, Take It to the Bridge, Unlocking the Great Songs Inside You, with the wonderful Chicago musician Steve Dawson. He's doing a residency on Monday nights at the Hideout, just like as Robbie Fulks had been doing for a long time. And so on September 11th, we're doing Take It to the Bridge, Bridge-a-Palooza, where we're going to have Steve and Kelly Hogan and Nora O'Connor and a whole bunch of other people, Rachel Drew. They're all going to be singing songs that have their favorite bridges in them, and then hopefully we'll get some people interested in our songwriting book, too.
Well, that about wraps it up for the download, and I just want to thank all you guys. What a treat to have Mark's group live.
You've now been at a writer's group. Next time you can meet us at a bar without microphones.
I actually have to go to it. Thanks for coming in, guys.
More fun with the beer.
Yeah, Mark and I will be right back, everybody.